Amazon, Amma Hazax, by Hassan Rashid, by Hashid. First chapter. Title, The Victim. Like all the nomads before me who made tracks across the vast expanses of endless deserts, I search for the oasis where all can be quenched with sweet waters of wisdom. And if you ask me if I will reach that oasis in my lifetime, I will say, read the blood-soaked note in the mouth of the splattered body on the sidewalk beneath the Empire State Building. Detective Harry Stone was holding the note with the tip of his latex glove-covered fingers, trying to make out the rest of the words, but was unable to do so because it was crumpled, wet, and half-torn. "This can't be a suicide note," exclaimed Harry to Jody, the policewoman who called in the incident. "No, it is not," she said as she straightened her neck from trying to read the note at an angle. There was a large crowd of approximately 100 people gathered at the scene who watched the whole event unfold. "What is your name, ma'am?" asked Detective Roger Wilkes, who was Harry's sidekick, of a woman standing at the front of the crowd. "I am Ruth Bishop, officer." "And what did you see happen here, Miss Bishop?" "Well, it happened very quickly. At first, this naked man stood out on the ledge about there," as she pointed to about the 10th floor of the building. "Did he say anything while up there?" asked Roger. "No, he was bent over the windowsill with his back to the crowd. It looked like he was trying to get back in, but misstepped and fell. It was a terrible accident." Next chapter. Title: John Doe. Sally Springfield, the district attorney, was reading the coroner's report when she reached for the phone and called Detective Harry Stone. "Good morning, Harry. Did you get a chance to read the coroner's report on the jumper?" "Good morning, Miss Springfield." "No, I haven't read it yet," answered Harry. "He's a John Doe, Harry, and it says he fell accidentally. We didn't find any ID on him, and the fingerprints and dental records came back negative. Besides, there was also no sign of forced entry into the office he jumped from." "Well, something smells fishy about it. It makes no sense that a man would fall off a ledge anonymously. I want you to dig deeper, Harry. There was too much publicity on the case in the media, and we are looking bad right now." "Roger," yelled Harry across the room as he put down the phone, "we have an assignment and gotta go." Next chapter. Title: 12 years earlier, Maggie Smith was a freshman at the American University in Cairo, Egypt. She is the daughter of Albert Smith, who was a tropical disease specialist at the Nemro Clinic in Cairo. Maggie wanted to be like her father and fight for the health of people in third world countries. She was 5'8" tall, with red hair, a slender build, and a tattoo of a heart on her right ankle. She grew up in Billings, Montana, where she finished junior high school. She attended Cairo American College in the Cairo suburb of Mahdi and played saxophone at the Mahdi Sporting Club. Alexandros Alex Panzaris is from Chios, a Greek island near the coast of Turkey in the Aegean Sea. He is tall with blue eyes, thick brown hair, and a slender build. Alex was told when he was 11 years old that his great-grandfather, Dimitri Panzaris, went to Egypt and there made a fortune. He spent the next 7 years dreaming of following in his great-grandfather's footsteps, and when he was 18 years old, he decided to go to that ancient land and get an education at the American University in Cairo. He met an Armenian from Syria named Ismail. Ismail was 5'10" tall, with olive skin, deep dark brown eyes, and wavy hair that was showing a bald spot at the top, which he tried to comb over. Alex and Ismail studied together, became best friends, and shared an apartment near the university. Ismail's left eye would water a lot and wink repeatedly, and Alex wondered why. Whenever he asked Ismail about it, Ismail would cover it, look in the other direction, and walk away. He wondered what could have happened to him to make his eye do that all the time. Alex knew that his eyes watered whenever he was walking against a strong wind or when he was in deep sorrow, for example. Alex was uncommitted as far as a major was concerned for the first 2 years, but had to choose one as he started the third year. He was excellent in mathematics, such as trigonometry and calculus, but thought it was dull and less important than the biological sciences, so he declared biology as his major and dived wholeheartedly into ecology and genetics. He chose ecology because it talked about the big picture, or whole biotas, and the interactions of species, while genetics gave him the fundamental tools to build ecological models. In his third year, he met Maggie in one of his lab sessions while dissecting a squalus shark, rubbed elbows with her, and was instantly smitten. Now, Alex came from a very old-fashioned and conservative family. In his younger years, he was not allowed to be with a girl unless a chaperone was present. So his skills in meeting and interacting with girls or women on his own were limited to the point that she was the one who asked him out. At that point, they were both biology majors and spent hours exploring things like complex adaptations, where whole biological structures, such as antlers, would appear to a species that had no antlers to start with. And yes, the conversation turned once to Ismael's blinking left eye, and Maggie said that he was probably slapped very hard on the left side of his face at a very young age. Alex would offer his arm when they walked together, would hold the chair out when she was being seated, and open the taxi door for her whenever they were out and about. Their relationship progressed. She invited him to her apartment, where she would help him make foreplay. The bedroom scene lasted for 2 nights. She would comment on his well-endowed and large organ, but at last, she cut him off suddenly, giving no reason. Alex asked Ismael to intervene. You see, Alex fell in love with Maggie and was having a hard time being separated from her. He could not eat, sleep, or concentrate. Please, Ismael, I implore you, go and explain to Maggie that I love her and can't live without her. Like a loyal friend, Ismael approached Maggie a day later. Maggie, Alex thinks of you all the time. Maggie replied, I like him too. Ismael started to feel awkward about what he needed to say next. He's in love with you, you know. Yes, I know, and... She hesitated, fell silent, and walked away. Needless to say, Alex was devastated that Ismael couldn't persuade Maggie and was silent about his pounding heart, stomach pains, and the swirl in his head. He kept having the same dream over and over again. Maggie and he are making love on a bearskin rug in front of a fire, and as their torsos and limbs are intertwined, her eyes start to bulge out and she turns a shade of green, metamorphosing into a giant praying mantis that bites his head off, which rolls towards the fire. As it burned, his eyeballs started to bubble, waking him up screaming and in a sweat. Yet, while he was awake, he could not get her out of his head. He pondered why that was, and rationalized that his subconscious was trying to save him by portraying Maggie as a cruel praying mantis, while his conscious adored her. There was one person who noticed Alex's droopy posture and drained look. Karen suggested that he lay down on top of the picnic table at the end of the food court, close his eyes, and visualize he is on the beach listening to the waves come in and go out. That seemed to help for an hour or two, but then he would succumb to the thoughts of Maggie once again. Alex dived into his studies as a means of distracting his mind from thoughts of Maggie. In his readings for his master's thesis, he ran across a discovery that blew his mind. Egypt had the only known fossils of either land or amphibian whales that existed some 35 million years ago. These were whales that had legs. I've got to see this sight, he thought to himself, and managed to beg Ismael, an English major, to come along during summer break. Ismael agreed to go, thinking it would help Alex get his mind off of Maggie. They planned to visit the site of the legged whale's graveyard, and then move on to a large oasis called Dakhla, where Ismael would document life there for his thesis. They estimated the whole trip should not take more than 3 days. They rented a Jeep Wrangler and set out at 6 a.m. on June 25, 1969. The Legged Whale's graveyard was about 150 kilometers, 90 miles away. The desert road was freshly paved and much improved from just a few years earlier, when it was punctuated by various sized potholes and covered with piles of sand most of the way. The original road was built by the British in the early 1900s when they occupied Egypt. Little improvements had been made until a year or so ago. Alex and Ismael took turns driving and staying on the road, for they were warned of scattered patches of landmines in the sand left there since WU2. At a point on the road, they encountered a detour sign for the whale graveyard. It was a dirt road lined on each side by old 55-gallon drums filled with sand every 50 yards or so. They had to maneuver rocks and gulches in this barren landscape for about 8 miles, and finally, they reached the graveyard. The site consisted of hills and gullies, with the skeletons scattered at random. Each skeleton was outlined by rocks, and so were the paths that led to it. The trip so far took approximately 4 hours, and they had to stop and wring out their headbands, admiring the complete solitude of the western desert. The sun was at high noon now, and unbearable, so they took cover in the small museum, housing a few of the whale skeletons, for about an hour, while they wetted their parched throats and ate a bit before proceeding on foot to the first skeleton in its natural setting in a gully outside. A pamphlet from the museum explained the whales were trapped in a lake that slowly shrank as geologic conditions changed, dying near one another. The skeletons were fossilized, which helped preserve them for this long. Alex turned to Ismail, asking if the skeleton's father insisted that he study hard for final exams, and therefore never had the opportunity to lose its arms and take off and swim like a normal whale. Ismail turned to Alex and said, "You dummy, these bones look like they belong to crocodiles, not whales. They had to study hard." Alex took his time documenting what he saw of the whales, and as the sun started on its way down to the horizon, Ismail pulled on Alex's sleeve, urging him to wrap it up and think of departing. Alex finally gave in, and they proceeded to the jeep, packed up their notes, and started to make it to the main road before dark. But Ismail mistook a barrel on the left side of the dirt road when it was really on the right. They proceeded with caution at the point they ran out of barrels and realized they were lost. With the headlights now on high beam, they debated whether to stop or proceed. They flipped a coin and then started rolling again, hoping to make it before dusk was gone. Suddenly, a huge explosion tossed the jeep to the driver's side. Alex was thrown out and lay unconscious for a while on the ground. When he awoke, it was pitch dark except for the light of the full moon. He looked around for the jeep and saw its shadow about 5 yards away. Hoping Ismail was all right, he limped towards the jeep, calling for him. Ismail responded, "I am over here, Alex, under the jeep." Alex discovered that Ismail's leg was pinned between the door and the half-buried door jamb. Alex was feeling dizzy now and realized he had a concussion, but was lucid enough to know what to do. He started to dig the sand out from under the jeep door, slowly releasing Ismail's leg. After getting him free, they figured his leg was broken. By that time, they were both exhausted, and so they lay where they were until daybreak, covered with articles of clothing scattered by the blast and rounded up by Alex. Alex felt a little better by then and thought about Ismail's broken leg. He knew he had to keep it straight so it wouldn't heal crooked. Alex strapped a straight piece of the muffler to the leg with long strips of cloth torn from a pair of jeans. They stayed there hiding in the capsized jeep to keep cool during the day and protected from the cool elements at night. All the sandwiches were gone by the end of the first day out there, and the water lasted until the second day. They realized they had wandered far from the barreled road, and the chances of them being found by a visitor to the archaeological site was slim. Alex thought of going for help by walking west towards the main road, but he wasn't sure he could find Ismail again if he found help. Next chapter. Title: The Camel's Hoof. By the fifth day, Alex's mind was entertaining thinking they were going to be a tragic statistic. The saliva in their mouths was all sticky now, and they hardly had the effort to speak to one another. They could make out large birds flying overhead through their blurred vision. All they could do was lay under the capsized jeep, breathing heavily and hoping. As Alex lay asleep at dusk, an avalanche of sand started to cover his face. When he tried to wipe the sand away, he noticed a large split hoof pushing more sand down on him. He managed to get up and out from underneath the jeep to find himself standing in front of a camel. He started to return underneath the jeep when he realized the camel was not afraid of him and that it could be part of a herd belonging to someone like a nomad. "Help!" he yelled. "Help! Help!" as loud as he could. He tried yelling again, but to no avail. He could not see anything moving around him near or far, nor could he hear anything besides the whisper of the wind across the sand in response. He got back under the jeep and went to sleep, not knowing if he would wake up again. The next morning, he heard some commotion and the sound of a complaining camel nearby. It was a camel in the process of kneeling with a figure riding it. The figure got off the camel's back and proceeded towards the jeep. The figure had a long object in its hand, and at first Alex thought it was a knife or sword of some sort, but as he got closer, the figure had a stick and poked at Alex in the ribs. Alex yelled out in pain, and immediately the man started to shout something in Arabic. Soon two women showed up. They dragged them both from the jeep and took them to a flat rock not too far from the jeep. They then seated and covered them both with a white cloth from head to toe despite the intense heat. "Comment allez-vous? Ça va?" asked the man. "I speak English," replied Alex. "Yes, yes, are you well?" asked the man. "How long have you been under the jeep?" "I don't remember. Maybe 5 or 6 days," replied Alex. "Here, drink this," the man said and gave Alex water from a goatskin container. Alex drank a couple of swigs when the man grabbed the goatskin away, saying, "Now that is enough for now." The man then offered the water goatskin to Ismail, who was delirious at this point and unaware of what was going on. "My name is Ali Mustafa," he said, holding out his hand. Alex replied as he shook hands, "I am Alex, and this is my friend Ismail. Welcome to my family and home," he said, pointing to three camels, heavy with what appeared to be a lot of sticks and cloth. There was also a small herd of goats roaming around and a dog. Ali then offered the two slivers of food that were a mixture of what looked like grain and dates pressed together and had to be cut with a knife from a block. "Here, eat this. It will give you energy and health." Ali then excused himself and started to work on a stretcher for Ismail, who was dragged behind one of the camels. Alex was seated on another camel when they all started to move south of where the sun had arisen that morning. By dusk, the family pitched their tents and settled for the night right in the middle of nowhere. In the light of the moon, sitting outside the communal tent, Ali was holding a drum and singing while his wives echoed back what he was singing about. After the song was over, Ali asked Alex why he and Ismail were out in the wilderness that day. Alex told him about their situation and how they got lost and eventually struck a mine. "I was fascinated by the prospect of seeing the legged whales. I don't think such a sight can be found anywhere else on Earth." "Where are you from?" asked Ali. "I'm from Cairo, where I go to the American University." "Ah, so you are American." "No, I am Greek," responded Alex. "That explains your blue eyes and fair skin. How about your brother, Ismail?" "He is Syrian," responded Alex. "You speak very good English, Ali. Where did you learn it?" "I used to live in the city of Luxor with my family. I was taught English in grade school and French in high school." "Why'd you choose to be out here and not working in the city?" asked Alex. "Don't get me wrong, Alex. I did work in the city as an architect for a large construction company after college. But I soon disliked working for someone else, and I tried to work on my own, but I had to deal with humanity on a larger scale." Alex was silent for a moment, perplexed why an architect would choose to live in tatters in the desert. "So you had a hard time working with people?" "Well, to put it mildly, I could not take their pettiness." "But why turn here to the desert?" asked Alex. "Not only do I get away from people, but I get closer to Allah," said Ali, as he looked up at the billion stars saturating the night sky. Alex wanted to challenge him on his decision, but was taught not to discuss politics or religion when in mixed company, and slowly excused himself, crawling into the guest tent with Ismail. After eating a few dates and drinking goat's milk the next morning, the women helped pack up, and they all set out to what seemed to be nowhere in this barren land. "Where are we going?" asked Alex. "There is an oasis about 2 days' journey from here," explained Ali. Alex could not figure out how this miserable desert could support the needs of a family like Ali's. On the second day of the journey, Alex decided to walk along with Ali, allowing the women to ride his camel. Ismail was still traveling on the stretcher, but much more alert by then. Alex built up the gumption to ask Ali about why he chose to live this way and not with all the resources provided by civilization. "Ali, surely there is a trade-off between what you call the pettiness of people and the wealth they provide in an enlightened setting like the city of Luxor. For example, you could have had your car to travel much faster from one oasis to the next." Ali chuckled and said, I can't call the city of Luxor enlightened. It is all about greed and making alliances to distribute its ill-gotten wealth. How can you say that? Asked Alex. There is no greed there. It is just a process of working hard and smartly that makes wealth. Ali now laughs out loud. You have described actions of working hard and smart, and that is not wealth. The wealth you are talking about is from raping the earth. I wouldn't call it raping the earth. It is more like working the soil of earth. Ali laughs again. Call it what you may. It is taking Allah's perfect creation and making it into our imperfect invention. As the word Allah crept into the conversation, Alex once again fell silent, lest it turn into a discussion of religion. On the third day, they reached the water well described by Ali as the oasis. Around it were date trees and other greenery that made it feel a few degrees cooler than the surroundings. There was a sense of happiness in everyone's eyes. Even the goats felt like jumping and running around. They pitched the tents for the night, and as the stars started to saturate the sky, Alex asked Ali, I still can't see what draws you to this desert. Ali responded, This desert is as close to heaven as we can get. Everything is provided from food and water to shelter and protection from the elements. It is all free. Neither I nor my wives have to do anything except to travel from one oasis to the next, and all is provided. Don't you wish you had more? What would I do with more than what I need? You could trade it for anything you may need to make your life easier, responded Alex. Me and my family have everything we need, and it is free. We don't have to do very much, maybe an hour or two a day collecting Allah's gift to us. What could be easier than that? Responded Ali. Ismail then walked over to where they were sitting without the supporting muffler brace and said he could walk. Good, said Ali. What was wrong with your leg then? I guess it was just badly bruised, said Ismail. That is great news, said Ali. There is a large town called Beni Suef east of here, and it is now within half a day's walking distance. I am sure both of you are anxious to get home. You can make it there tomorrow. It is an easy walk. Next chapter. Title: Lover's Revenge. Alex and Ismail made it to Cairo by hitchhiking from Beni Suef. When they got home, they tried to rest, but news got out that they were back. Their friends gathered in their apartment, and soon there was standing room only for those who wanted to listen to their adventure. As the evening progressed, people started to excuse themselves and go home. As the living room cleared, there was a quiet figure in the corner sitting. Alex recognized right away it was Maggie and rushed right over. He reached for her hand, and she offered hers, and instantly the ice between them started to melt. I'm sorry for brushing you off the way I did, she said. It was painful for sure, but let's not talk about that right now, he said. He pulled her closer, and she did not resist. You must be tired, Alex. I should be going, she said. Yeah, but I will come over to your place tomorrow, and we can share dinner, he said. Tomorrow is the leftover day, if you don't mind. Leftovers are my specialty, he responded. The next evening, Alex knocked on Maggie's door. He had to wait for about 45 seconds before she answered. She was dressed in a bright flowery dress instead of her usual jeans, and she motioned him in. They sat on the couch together as the awkward moments passed by in silence. Suddenly, Alex asked where the refrigerator was. She ushered him into the kitchen, where he requested a large pot, and she got it for him. He placed the pot on the stove and opened the fridge, looking inside at what leftovers there were. There was what looked like beef stroganoff, so he dumped it in the pot. Next came the mashed potatoes, pickles, and a couple of pieces of sweet pastries, all of which he put in the pot. Then there was a half bottle of orange Fanta, which he held in his hand for about 20 seconds, thinking. He then dumped it into the pot as he twisted the knob on the stove to turn on the burner under the pot. After the cook was done with his masterpiece, they both sat down at the table, and, with the pot between them, he served them both what could only be called slop. Needless to say, neither one of them dared sample it, and they decided to go out. Before leaving, though, Maggie tells Alex to return the next evening and that she will fix something special for him. The next evening, Alex again knocked on Maggie's door, but this time she greeted him in her jeans, ready to do her thing. She asked him to sit at the kitchen table, which he did, and then told him that his hair needed some loving care. He then knew that something was up, but being the fun-loving guy that he was, he agreed to let her do whatever. She opened the fridge and pulled out a dozen eggs, which she cracked over his head and massaged into his scalp. Then came a couple of bottles of beer to wash away the eggs. Alex was a complete mess with egg and beer all over his head and clothes by the time Maggie was through with him. He had the choice of taking off his clothes and jumping into the shower, which he did, and they spent the rest of the evening in each other's arms, eating pizza for dessert. Next chapter. Title: Pretzels? With the advent of the new school year, Alex had recovered from his trip to the Valley of Wales and now had a solid love fixture in his life. First off, he started to apply to graduate schools in Europe and the USA with a twist as far as his interests were concerned. Because of Ollie's nomad philosophy, he was now interested in anthropology as well as biology and was hoping to be accepted into an interdisciplinary program. Alex completed his coursework, wrote his dissertation on the legged whales of Egypt's western desert, and was awarded a bachelor's degree in biology that year. However, throughout the year, he could not stop thinking of Ollie's lifestyle choice. Why would a person choose to live the most primitive of lives and ignore what technology has to offer in making a person's life easier and richer? He was accepted to several master's programs and chose to go to Oxford University. Although he could not find the interdisciplinary program he wanted, he decided to master in anthropology and then get his doctorate in biology. Maggie decided to take a few years off and work in a laboratory to analyze the effects of pesticides on the foods we eat after reading a book entitled Silent Spring. Luckily, she found such a lab at Oxford University associated with the biology department, and so the two of them were able to stay together. At Oxford, Alex was under the tutelage of Dr. Turbull, an aging scholar with wisdom oozing out of every elegant word he spoke. For the first 2 years, Alex caught up on what anthropology was all about, and in the third year, he decided to strike out on his own to study the ways of the human race. Dr. Turbull told him to head back to Africa in general and to the Shituro Forest in particular, for it was a place he had always wanted to study but never had the chance to. Alex looked up what he could find of the Shituro Forest and found out that it was a tropical rainforest covering approximately 27,000 square miles of the north-northeast section of the Congo, now known as the two nations of the Democratic Republic of the Congo and the Republic of Congo, Africa. The forest was inhabited by the Ngutria pygmy hunter-gatherers, who were some of the oldest indigenous people of the Congo region. It was not known how long they, the pygmy people, have been living in the Shituro Forest, but there have been reports of their existence since the pharaohs of Egypt approximately 4,000 years ago. Alex jumped at the opportunity, packed up, and kissed Maggie goodbye for what he thought was a 3-month summer tour of these forest people. As it turned out, he stayed there for approximately 6 months. Meanwhile, Ismail was accepted to a master's program in English literature at Princeton in the USA at the same time Alex was accepted at Oxford. He completed his master's in 2 years and then applied for a doctorate at Oxford University, arriving a few weeks after Alex departed for the Congo. Both Ismail and Maggie kept each other company while Alex was gone, and both grew quite fond of each other to the point that Ismail had feelings towards Maggie but kept his feelings to himself. Maggie felt something was going on from the way Ismail was paying so much attention to her, and she too kept her thoughts to herself. When Alex arrived home, only Maggie and Dr. Turbull were at the airport to greet him. Ismail felt awkward and decided not to go. Eventually, he came around and welcomed Alex home as Alex sat in his work cubicle at Oxford working on his scientific article and trip reports. They hugged and reminisced about the good old days in Egypt. Alex's report started by saying, "The Shituro Forest receives a large amount of rainfall annually, ranging from 50 to 70 inches. The dry season is relatively short, ranging from 1 to 2 months. The forest is a moist, humid region strewn with rivers and lakes. Too much rainfall, as well as droughts, can greatly diminish the food supply. The pygmy people are composed of bands ranging from 15 to 60 people, with a population hovering around 30,000 to 40,000 for the whole forest. Pygmy people of the forest are a happy group who in the rainy season forage in a part of the forest, and the dry season, they expand their foraging territories. Their wild foodstuffs include crabs, shellfish, ants, larvae, snails, pigs, antelope, monkeys, and fish, as well as honey. The plant component of their diet includes wild yams, berries, fruits, roots, leaves, and kola nuts. They also eat mushrooms. While hunting, the Ngutria have been known to specifically target the giant forest hog, which is often considered quarry, a bad animal that may cause illness to those who eat it, and is commonly used as a trade good between the Ngutria and agriculturalist Bantu groups. Folklore has it that the quarry giant forest hog is nocturnal and a disruptor of the few imported agricultural activities the Ngutria practice. Ngutria societies have no ruling group or lineage, no overlying political organization, and little social structure. The Ngutria are an egalitarian society in which the band is the highest form of social organization. Leadership may be displayed, for example, on hunting treks. Men and women have equal power. Issues are discussed and decisions are made by consensus at fire camps. Men and women engage in the conversations equally. If there is a disagreement, misdemeanor, or offense, then the offender may be banished, beaten, or scorned. The forest is the center of Ngutria life. They consider the forest to be their great protector and provider and believe that it is a sacred place. They sometimes call the forest mother or father. An important ritual is referred to as bongado. After the death of an important person in the tribe, bongado is noisily celebrated to wake up the forest in the belief that if bad things are happening to its children, it must be asleep and not taking care of them. As with many Ngutria rituals, the time it takes to complete a bongado is not rigidly set. Instead, it is determined by the mood of the group. Food is collected from each hut to feed the bongado, and in the evening the ritual is accompanied by the men dancing and singing around the fire. Women and children must remain in their huts with the doors closed. The remoteness of the Ngutria people has protected them and their environment from the outside world for the most part. And though their birth and death rates are high and roughly equal, there are no overpopulation problems. Modern advances, such as medicine and other technologies, have had a rough time reaching them. Although there is no formal constitution or government, the context of their being is in their belief system. They are one with the forest. All three of them quickly settled into their daily routines. Maggie, with her lab work, would work until 5 p.m., while Alex and Ismail had a little more leeway in their schedules. For example, Alex would rush home at about 3 p.m. to fix dinner for Maggie and Ismail, then hurry back to the university to finish up his work for that day. Alex's favorite cooking receptacle was a wok, in which he would cook up vegetables, a bit of meat, spices, and herbs. Each day, he would mix different veggies with different meats. Pretty soon, he got the process down to a science, until Maggie and Ismail started to complain. "Why not beef stroganoff once in a while?" she once asked. Well, he thought for a minute one day and decided to try something different. He cooked his usual in the wok, but on the side, he fried up about 10 strips of bacon. When he was done, he put the contents of the wok on a platter, covered it with the strips of bacon in a crisscross manner, and filled the bacon gaps with pretzels. Needless to say, that was the last day he ever cooked for Maggie and Ismail. Next chapter. Title: The Seven Pillars. Alex completed his dissertation on the forest people the next year and had set his sights on a biology doctorate program at Oregon State University, OSU, in Corvallis, Oregon, USA. He had no problem being accepted there, traveling in the summer with Maggie at his side. His focus at OSU was to be one of the reasons why the environments of the forest people and the nomads of Egypt's western desert were preserved for thousands of years, despite human presence. By Thanksgiving, Ismail decided he had enough of academia, quit his doctoral program, and traveled to Corvallis to be with his friends, especially Maggie. He moved in with them and started looking for a job. He found suitable employment as an editor for a local variety magazine, moving out to his place of residence, to Alex's relief, who was suspecting something was going on between Maggie and him. Alex hated confrontations, and believed, as far as matters concerning himself, to let nature take its course. He wrestled with this feeling of his for a long time. He knew he didn't feel all that great about non-confrontation, that there was always something telling him to act out when something of concern happened, but he always kept those feelings suppressed. One afternoon, he jotted down a few words trying to express how he felt that read, "Like all the nomads before me who made tracks across the vast expanses of endless deserts, I search for the oasis where all can be quenched with sweet waters of wisdom. And if you ask me if I will reach that oasis in my lifetime, I will say it doesn't matter." It took 6 years for Alex to complete his survey of lifestyles and environments as far as the desert nomads and the forest people before settling down to write his report. There were 7 glaring observations made. The first was the human density of each of the environments. For example, the human density today on Earth is approximately 129 individuals per square mile, according to the United Nations census, compared to 0.4 individuals per square mile for the desert nomads and 1.3 individuals for the forest people. He concluded that a median global density of 25 individuals per 30 square miles was ideal, so long as the individuals were hunter-gatherers or desert nomads. Second was the lack of technology in each of the 2 lifestyles. It wasn't that the forest people or desert nomads didn't have technology, but had very little evidence of it, which showed up in the form of small steel hunting or cutting utensils. There were other forms of technology in the way they fashioned their hunting and eating tools from indigenous materials. Third was the lack of any form of non-indigenous energy sources, such as fossil fuels. All energy into the system or the environment was local, be it sunshine, wood, leaves, or food, such as vegetables or meat. Fourth was the belief system that supported the idea that the immediate environment provided everything they needed for their livelihood. Indeed, they were part of and not apart from it. Fifth was the pristine condition of the environment studied, despite the human presence. Sixth, a nomadic style of life was present in both populations, which allowed the effects of the human presence in any one area a chance to recover naturally in their absence. Seventh, the birth and death rates were roughly equal for each population over the 6 years of the study. Next chapter. Title: Recognition. Summers at the Oregon coast were a gorgeous time to behold, with the rhododendrons in bloom and the salal berries ready to be picked. All 3 of them traveled there from Corvallis, which was a hopscotch away. They visited the different little towns with their unique aquariums and little souvenir shops. They also visited the various wayside parking areas to take in the view of the rugged coastline. It was there that they spotted a beautiful flowering plant alongside a trail path and decided to cut a few, although they knew it was illegal. They got to their hotel rooms thereafter and placed the flowers in vases they bought from a flower shop. They then went out for lunch. When they got back, they could not enter the hotel rooms on account of the stench coming out of them when they opened the doors. They ran to the manager, complaining that a skunk had entered their rooms somehow and sprayed all over the place. The manager quickly closed his desk and proceeded to the rooms. Unfortunately, there was no skunk present, but the skunk cabbage plant, which they had brought back. The manager quickly opened all the windows and took out the skunk cabbage flowers from their rooms, whispering under his breath, "Foreigners!" Alex based his dissertation on the 7 facts he had surmised from his research of the Egyptian desert nomads and forest people of the Congo. His presentation took about an hour, at the end of which he asked for questions. A voice from the back of the room rang out asking, "You stated that your subjects in the research did not do much work each day to sustain themselves compared to what modern people need to do, such as work 8 hours a day. But we all know that technology makes our lives much easier and we can afford a much higher standard of living." Alex responded, "You answered part of your question, sir. The subjects of my research worked approximately 2 to 4 hours a day while we worked 8. Which lifestyle would be easier?" Concerning the standard of living, that is a state of mind. The desert nomads and forest people are happy in their daily lives. Although the desert nomads do see other ways of life in their travels, they stick with their ways, while the forest people are shielded from the outside world and don't know anything different. On the other hand, we wouldn't feel comfortable living any other way than the way we are living today with our modern technologies and 8 hours a day schedule. Another voice from the audience spoke up asking, "Can you explain your expression state of mind and how it affects our choices in the way we live?" Our state of mind is supported by our physical environment and our belief system. The physical environment places limits on what we can do to survive. Our belief systems set rules of behavior and thought to affect a happy lifestyle within these limits. For example, behavioral rules include whether to marry the one you love or marry the one your parents choose for you, as many cultures do. Rules of thought have to do with, for example, whether you believe in an afterlife or not, answered Alex. In the end, the judges believed that Alex had a command of his subject matter and his research, and he was granted a doctorate in biology. Out of all the studies and research he did, Alex was impressed by the pristine condition of the environments he found the desert nomads and forest people in. He had the idea of finding a way for the rest of humanity can do the same. So, he decided to work in an industry that did a lot of damage to the environment to somehow get a handle on the problem. Next chapter. Title: Digging for Gold. Alex was honest about why he applied to the Bushnell Mining Company in California. He told the interviewer that he wanted to learn all he could of the mining business, and so he was hired as an environmental consultant responsible for writing environmental impact statements and other business reports that were now required by a fairly new organization called the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA. The company had 4 biologists making surveys of the land about the collection of species living there before and after the mining was completed. There was 1 geologist who handled that aspect of the mining site. There was the crew that did the digging, and so they had to be monitored as to their methods. Finally, there was the recovery crew who worked on restoring the environment so that it functioned as much as possible in the same way as it once did in supporting the pre-existing species. Alex's job was to coordinate all these activities and report to the company and the EPA the progress made toward achieving both the company's financial needs and the need to restore the environment once the work was done. He had to keep tabs on all 4 groups through daily, weekly, and monthly reports. In essence, he was a paper shuffler, report writer, chart designer, and information presenter. After a year of this repetitive exercise, he decided that there had got to be a better way to spend his time. So he took up a class on computers, hoping he could automate the process. At that time, personal computers were just coming out onto the market. He managed to talk management into purchasing 5 computers at a cost of approximately $5,000 each. He gave each one of the 4 groups a computer on which to enter data. He would then go from one group to the next, gathering the data on one disk and plugging that disk into his computer, which would merge and summarize all data and print the required reports and charts. This transformative work from manual to computer took 2 years to accomplish, and he had to work late hours to carry on the old way of doing the reports, presentations, and programming work he had to do to automate. This type of schedule was no stranger to Alex, for he had done it throughout his academic career years and thought nothing of it. Unfortunately, the company security officer had other ideas. Security manager O'Malley was convinced that what Alex was doing in the evenings was spying on the company's plans and methods of operation and selling this information to competitors. O'Malley convinced top management of the need to conduct a surveillance operation. O'Malley had Alex and Maggie's rental house bugged and secret surveillance cameras installed to keep track of who and when people were coming and going from the residence. This went on for a year, with no evidence of wrongdoing by Alex, and top management wanted to stop the operation. However, O'Malley insisted that there had to be a reason why Alex was spending so much of his time on company property and wanted the surveillance to continue. But management called on O'Malley to stop the surveillance program. Not willing to admit defeat, O'Malley whispered in the ear of Officer Chris Snipe, a National Security Service S agent, that Alex was a sneaky and dangerous anarchist in hiding and not to be trusted. Next chapter. Title? Revelations. Once the new computer system was in place, Alex turned to solving the problem he had originally sought by working for the Bushnell Mining Company. That problem was how to transform the mining operation into one that did not alter the environment, but left it pristine. With Ismail and Maggie at his side, they all discussed countless ways they could try to accomplish such a feat. They soon found the problem intractable. They then turned to why mining was so important and needed in the first place, and why we could not live without it. They turned back to the history of mining and discovered that it was aided in three ways. The first was the advent of capitalism, which rested on the availability of energy to fuel the competition in the use of technology to meet the needs of a growing population in material goods deliveries. They also recognized that technology played a critical role in increasing the human population count of the Earth through the agricultural and health fields. All these factors contributed to the situation the Earth found itself in, as far as overpopulation and a degraded earthly environment. Once capitalism, technology, and the availability of fossil fuels took hold, a snowball effect of evolving lifestyles was generated until it reached the way it is from a much simpler one way back, maybe 1,000 years ago. And being a creature of habit and resistant to abrupt change, the thought of humans returning to a so-called primitive hunter-gatherer nomadic lifestyle was something Alex thought was impossible to do. But the word, impossible, wasn't in Alex's vocabulary, and so he proceeded to pursue a solution. He knew that to get humanity off its comfortable setting, he needed a way to kick them off of it. To do that, he compiled as many of the environmental and social shortcomings of the current human lifestyles in an easily read report entitled The Dark Side of Capitalism. Next, he had to formulate a target for what the human population count should be to save the Earth in its present condition. Since the land area of the Earth is approximately 57 million square miles, and we previously estimated the land area required for desert nomads was 0.4 individuals per square mile, and for the forest people it was 1.3 individuals per square mile of land, we can safely say that the Earth can withstand approximately 48 million individuals living the hunter-gatherer lifestyle instead of the 7 billion people that inhabited it at that moment. He then had to formulate a way of getting from close to 7 billion individuals down to 48 million. He thought for a moment and did some calculations, then said, "What is needed is a method of gradually reducing non-indigenous fuel use to zero." Non-indigenous fuels are fossil, nuclear, wind, solar, and hydro fuels. Many of these fuels depend on fossil fuels for the construction of power plants. By reducing carbon emissions by 70 pounds per person per year every year for 30 years, it will also reduce many of the other power sources. Power plants such as nuclear and solar need to be decommissioned and destroyed at the rate of 0.03 units per year. This approach would result in two achievements. The first is that in the year 2021, there will be zero non-indigenous fuel use. The second is the possibility the planet will be saved and able to recover. He continued, "Another opportunity is the altruistic act of voluntary zero births through mass contraception, except for a select group of humans who will act as our seed for generations to come. The difficult task here is the selection process. We hope that all so-called primitive tribes be exempt from this contraception effort. They have survived without damaging their environments the longest, are best equipped physically and socially, and have the right belief systems to be the most suitable seed." Alex then looked at Maggie and said, "No single approach from the opportunities presented will work by itself. The path to these goals is difficult to say the least, causing social disruption and mass population relocation since the present world economies are largely dependent on these fuels. But we must assure a favorable outcome for the Earth's biota, including our own, sooner rather than later." "But aren't both approaches altruistic in nature?" added Maggie. "I suppose you are right," responds Alex. "I think then that concept should be our approach," concluded Maggie. Alex was well aware of the dangers involved in their search and dissemination of its results. He explained to Maggie that cultures tend to reject offhand intruders. Any given culture protects the patents of their successful way of life, rejecting any challenges or modifications from the outside. Maggie sensed that something was missing from Alex's approach, but she could not put her finger on it. Next chapter. Title: The Missing Approach. The next morning, Maggie awoke and shouted in Alex's ear while he was still asleep, "People need to have faith in your approach." Rubbing his eyes and putting his glasses on as he tries to wake up, he asked, "Faith in what approach?" "Faith in your solution to the environmental problems will work to their benefit." "Come on, baby, wake up. You have work to do," responded Maggie. After the Sunday breakfast, Alex looked into his King James Bible for any mention of preserving the environment or earth, but couldn't find anything. On the contrary, the earth was there for the service of man and to fulfill his every wish. There was no penalty for defiling the earth in any shape or form. It soon became apparent to Alex that Christianity as an established religion was of no help. This was not the outcome he was hoping for, because religion or the faith of people was a very important part of who they were. As far as he could see, he had two choices. The first, create a new religion, and the second was to change the current religious beliefs by modifying of current scriptures. The first choice was clearly out of his league, for he was not a Messiah in any way or form. He also felt that modification of a belief system through its scriptures, by either taking away or adding to them, would weaken the religion and make it lose its integrity. By that time, Ismail had joined in the conversation and added, "Religious preachers have used excerpts from the Bible to prove their point, and I think we could do the same. For example, the Bible teaches us to be fruitful and multiply, so how can we multiply if we destroy the environment in which our children are supposed to flourish and multiply themselves?" Alex responded, "I think you have got it, Ismail. Your suggestion requires no new religion or modification of existing scriptures, and therefore maintains its integrity." "That is okay, Alex, but what do we do about the people who are not religious?" added Maggie. "There are no scriptures or anything written down to use to try to convince them to make an effort to save the planet. We will have to come up with something to persuade them to move into action. Maybe appeal to their emotions that compels them to save the children of their neighbors or the world," responded Alex. "I agree with what you are saying, Alex," responded Maggie. "We need to rely on the core of their being. We can lean on their sense of altruism to give them the motivation to do something for the good of all. We can appeal to their selflessness and urge the protection of the approximately 100 gardens of Eden left in existence today that are the homes of the uncontacted hunter-gatherer nomads, where everything is provided free of charge. So we have a few loose ends to our argument, which are challenging to say the least. I know I will think about how to solve these issues in the coming days, and I hope you will also entertain solutions. But right now, I need to solidify the conclusions we have made by documenting them. I also need to formulate what the rules are to be for the new society that develops," said Alex. Next chapter. Title: Soapbox Time. It was decided that Alex take his ideas on the road to spread the good news that there was a way out of the current environmental quagmire. Logistically, Alex could not work at the Bushnell Mining Company and also go around the country spreading the word, so Ismail and Maggie decided to support him in his on-the-road lectures. Alex spent a month preparing his speeches and having Ismail and Maggie help him get the delivery down to a science. Once that was done, he traveled to Portland, Oregon, and moved into his Hilton hotel room, where he contacted advertisers and publicists who would solicit the audiences to his venue. Alex split his presentation into six sessions. The first was titled History of Capitalism. The second session was titled What Needs to Be Done. The third was titled Benefits of the Hunter-Gatherer Lifestyle. The fourth was titled The Rules of the Hunter-Gatherer. And the fifth was titled Action Plans. The last and sixth session was titled Conclusion. His first speech was on the history of capitalism and it was presented at the Portland Public Library's conference room. Alex started by saying, "The feudal landlord and serf system started to give way to urbanization in Europe approximately in the 12th century AD. Towns were built and roads had been laid to connect them and to the land. As towns grew into cities, merchant capitalism developed, which involved capital resources used to hire people who were willing to exchange labor for monies in working the land, providing services or handmade products. Merchant capitalism also included renting land or products as well as lending monies. Sir Francis Bacon in the 1600s, among others, advocated the use of the scientific method in research. This ushered in the Industrial Revolution in the 1800s with the invention of machines that were driven by readily available fossil fuels, replacing primitive biomass-dependent services and handmade products. In essence, the feudal system of landlord and serf was replaced by two human organizations in the industrial capitalistic age. The first was the town or city, such as London, where the masses needed goods, and the second was the factory that used paid laborers to provide these goods. As far as the factory was concerned, capitalism was the production of goods in exchange for monies that was driven by the desire for personal accumulation of wealth in a free market system, where the needs and wants of consumers are the driving forces of such markets. In addition, capitalism as an economic system and mode of production can be summarized by the following. Private ownership of the means of production. The investment of money to make a profit. Capital accumulation. Production for profit and accumulation of wealth as the implicit purpose of all or most production organizations and the elimination of production formerly carried out on a common social or private household. Basis. Commodity production. Production for the exchange of goods for monies based on maximizing exchange value. The inhabitants of these towns and cities recognized that capitalism had a dangerous aspect in the free market equation, namely the formation of monopolies that did more harm than good to the consumers. Laws were introduced to prevent such monopolies and encourage competition. This competition introduced the drive for innovation in the form of cost reduction, substitute goods, and new product introduction technologies. A hand rose from the audience. "Yes, do you have a question?" exclaimed Alex, pointing to the raised hand. "What is a monopoly?" asked a voice from the crowd. "A monopoly exists when a specific person or enterprise is the only supplier of a particular commodity. Monopolies are thus characterized by a lack of economic competition to produce the good or service, a lack of viable substitute goods, and the possibility of a high monopoly price well above the seller's marginal cost that leads to a high monopoly profit. In economics, a monopoly is a single seller. In law, a monopoly is a business," replied Alex. "Did I answer your question?" "Yes," said the voice in the crowd. Alex went on, "With the advent of capitalism and competition, a slight increase in global population level can be detected during the 1500 to 1800s AD, as shown in the following chart. The discovery and availability of fossil fuels became abundant through technological advances brought on by competition in the capitalistic market system, resulting in the exponential growth of Earth's population from approximately 800 million in 1700 AD to 7 billion today. With the increase of population count is an increase in the consumption of resources extracted from the Earth to the point that some are being depleted beyond economic value, such as critical minerals, as can be observed in the following table, for example. It is predicted that the population of the Earth will plunge to about 2 billion or less from 9 billion in 30 to 100 years as a result of this overconsumption of Earth's resources. The departure of the human capitalistic system with its focus on profits in the pursuit of consumer needs and wants from Mother Nature's way of energy conservation and resource recycling has caused many unpleasant side effects that are ruining most, if not all, Earth's biological habitats. Humans behave as if they are the most important being on Earth. With fossil fuel as a power source and this motivation, humans set out to control their destiny and proceeded to tame the world. Instead of a cyclical existence, they felt comfortable with a straight line. So they built square homes, towns, and cities. They denuded the jungle and built farms with machinery that could only go in one direction. and so farmland was divided into square or rectangular fields. Instead of being a part of the circular food chain, humans chose to be at the top of a food pyramid. If a creature was thought to be useful to human existence, it was domesticated or farmed. If it was not thought of as being useful to humans, it was ignored or eliminated. Instead of being more efficient in the use of energy, humans became less so by huge infusions of fossil fuels. They built their monetary systems based on increasing the profit margins of companies and individuals by teaching the need for material goods and services and meeting the public's demand for them. Energy was no longer a precious resource, but a way to heat economies that support material-based growing populations. Instead of being a part of the biota, they chose to be apart from it. Title: The Efforts of Officer Chris Snipe to Save Civilization. I tell you, sir, this Alex Panzaris guy is dangerous, said Chris Snipe to his commanding officer, Captain Al Marvin of the National Security Service. He is advocating the takedown of our whole civilization. He is a Greek who lived in Egypt for 4 or 5 years, where he hobnobbed with the Russians, and even spent some time in a secret place in the western Egyptian desert receiving training. He is a prime candidate for surveillance, sir. Very well, Chris. Do you need assistance from any of our crew? Asked Al. No, sir, I can handle it, responded Chris. Chris went down to the weapons department and asked for a gun that could attach a pulley to a beam sticking out horizontally from a building that could pull 400 pounds. Yes, Chris, I have just the thing for you. It is our model GH-500 and is very dependable, responded the technician. Alex's hotel room was on the second floor, and Chris needed a way to see into it over some trees. The hotel room had a bay window facing the parking structure. Chris shot the gun up in the direction of the beam that was sticking out, and the grappling hook secured the pulley firmly to it. The pulley was pre-threaded with a nylon rope. Chris attached two large buckets to the nylon rope ends, filled one with 200 pounds of sand, and hoisted it up to the pulley. He then got into the other bucket with his surveillance equipment, let loose of the rope that held him to the ground, and suddenly the bucket of sand started on its way down, pulling Chris up to the pulley. It was dark. Chris and his equipment weighed much less than 200 pounds, and so the pulley operation went considerably faster than he had expected. The bucket of sand hit Chris on the head halfway down. When the bucket of sand hit the ground, the sand spilled out, and it became much lighter than Chris and his equipment. As Chris was free-falling in his bucket, the sand bucket hit him in the head once again on its way up. As Chris hit the ground with a thud, he fell out of his bucket. The sand bucket still had about 50 pounds of sand in it, and as it reached the pulley, it started to plunge, landing on Chris's head. Chris lay unconscious on the ground until a dog started to lick his bleeding wounds, at which point he got up and drove himself to the hospital. He was not discouraged by this setback and decided to change his tactics. He decided to attend the rest of the presentations that were advertised. Next chapter. Title: What Needs to be Done? This was the second session where Alex laid down what humanity was up against in the matters of environmental degradation and the options it faced about reducing the Earth's population count from 7 billion individuals to approximately 48 million. He started by summarizing the last presentation and said, "As competition to satiate the accumulation of wealth drove the provision of more products and services for consumers, an improved public health system developed, and the age of death was pushed back, leading to an increase in the population count that grew exponentially. Competition also increased the quantities of goods and services for this growing population, fueled by energy readily available in the form of fossil and other sources of energy. In our zero-sum world on Earth, something had to give, and it was not the insatiable wants of humans, but Earth's provisions of minerals and the rest of its life-supporting biota. The task in front of us now is to find out how to abate this human destructive bloom. A popular term used to measure the impact of humans on Earth is the ecological footprint, where the bigger the impact, the bigger the footprint. Ecological footprint is a standardized measure of human needs from Earth's ecosystems. It measures the human demand for natural resources that are contrasted with the Earth's ability to regenerate them. It represents the amount of biologically productive land and sea areas necessary to supply the resources humans consume and to assimilate the resulting waste if a population follows a given lifestyle. Humanity's total ecological footprint is estimated at 1.5 planet Earths. That is, humanity uses up ecological resources 1.5-fold more quickly than the Earth can renew them. We have been living off of the principal in our bank account, as well as the interest. In other words, to get to the fruit, we have been cutting down its tree. This is a huge impact, and the writing is on the wall that the Earth will completely run out of ecological resources in the not-too-far future. What we need to do now is reverse this process of consumption and adopt a lifestyle that has zero footprint. There are many ideas proposed to do that, one of which is sustainability. Sustainability is a term that has been used by many to try to describe a lifestyle that allows for an economy that protects the environment, preserves essential ecosystem functions, and provides for the well-being of future generations. This means environmental and economic policy must be integrated, and the goal of policy should be an improvement in the overall quality of life, not just income growth. Poverty must be ended and resources distributed more equally, and all sections of society must be involved in decision-making. There are all kinds of ideas as to how to make sustainability happen. One idea I ran across was a plan to raise a human family on a quarter of an acre of land. The idea is simple. Take only as little as possible land under intensive farming. Unfortunately, the tools it requires include an axe, shovel, rake, and metal chicken coop hinges, to name a few steel-based implements that would have to be bought from a steel factory, and that defeats the whole purpose of sustainability. I argue that the term sustainability has been hijacked and twisted to suit governmental, business, and individual interests that want to continue with the way things are. For example, there is no quantifiable target of what the sustainable future looks like. There are no quantifiable parameters with which to measure any type of progress towards sustainability. In summary, sustainability is only a feel-good state of mind for human individuals, corporate leaders, and governments in the current state of our planet. In this series of presentations, I calculated two goals that promote true sustainability. They are the elimination of non-indigenous fuels used and the reduction of the size of the human population on Earth to 48 million individuals practicing the hunter-gatherer nomadic lifestyle. When these two goals are met, the Earth will be able to sustain itself. He then asked the audience, "Does anybody know what impact a deer has on its natural environment?" There was silence. Alex had to hold back from answering his question for the longest time when a voice spoke up and said, 50%. Alex responded, "Less than that." The voice returned with, 25%. "You are on the right track." "It is 0%, said Alex, who went on, "You see, the deer is part of the environment. It can't afford to degrade the environment it is in because it will be degrading itself. We must become wise to the fact and consider ourselves a part of and not apart from the living local environment, the web, and the biota on Earth. Notions like humans are at the top of the food chain and humans have superior intelligence have continuously crept into everyday talk and the literature as an expression of our naturally blind drive for superiority." He went on and said, "It must be emphasized that humans are not at the top of the food chain, but they are a link no better or worse than any other link, be it a clump of mud or another species in the web of life. For humanity to survive, it must leave the environment the way it found it. Otherwise, it will continue to degrade until there is nothing left. This can only be achieved by not ingesting or consuming anything that did not originate from our local and immediate environment. That means we must not ingest anything processed, manufactured, or imported, because this kind of nutrition only returns us into the endless loop of self-destruction. We must be willing to thank our sources of food, earth, and the sun, because they are the providers. In addition, we must not leave behind anything that can't be consumed by those who are next in line of our local living environment. Further, we must not use implements that do not come from our locality. We can use anything that occurs naturally, such as local stones, tree branches, leaves, and the like. A voice echoed on the left side of the room from a man with a large bandage on his head. I suppose you will next have us swinging from tree to tree like monkeys. The room broke out laughing. Thank you for your comic relief, but if that is what it takes to save the earth, then be it as it may. To get back to the serious matter at hand, let me turn your attention to my publication, The Dark Side of Capitalism, which details some of the major headline damages we are committing to our environment, responds Alex as he handed it out to the audience. Without turning a page in this publication, can anyone give me an example of the damage we are doing to the environment? Asked Alex. A young man with thick glasses raised his hand. Yes, what is it you want to say? Asked Alex. The young man stood up and said, It has been reported in the local newspaper that there is no doubt in the minds of biologists that the Earth is losing a race with time to save its precious cargo. The article went on to say that in 1993, Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson estimated that Earth was losing approximately 30,000 species per year, or 3 species per hour. This means that approximately 700,000 species have gone extinct since this estimate was made. This bio-die-off crisis is snowballing, and many experts predict the 6th mass extinction on the horizon. The newspaper article went on to say that there is no doubt that humans are the direct cause of this habitat stress and species destruction in the modern world through such activities as the transformation of the landscape through agriculture, mining, oil exploration, and fracking, construction and forestry practices, overhunting game species, pollution, human overpopulation, and introduction of invasive species into existing habitats. That is true, said Alex while holding up a copy of his publication. He continued, I will not go over what is in my booklet, but suffice to say that it is extremely important for anyone interested in the well-being of our planet. I will presently explain what we need to do to be able to swing from tree to tree, like the funny gentleman said just a few minutes ago. I did a study of people who did very little, if any, damage to the environment. One such people were the desert nomads of the Egyptian Western Desert. They have been living out there for as long as civilization has existed, and yet they haven't damaged their environments. Another group of people who have not damaged their environment are the forest people of the Congo in Africa. I have found that the desert nomads had a population density of 0.4 individuals per square mile, and the forest people had a population density of 1.3 individuals per square mile. This averages out to be about a population density of 0.85 individuals per square mile. Given that the land area on Earth is approximately 57 million square miles, I concluded that for humanity to preserve the environment it lives in, the population size needs to be in the range of 48 million individuals. Today, the human population of the Earth is approaching 7 billion. And I ask you to think of ways to rectify that, said Alex as he looked around the room for anybody willing to donate an idea. The room fell silent. Alex continues after 50 seconds. The driving force behind capitalism, economics, competition, and the advent of technology is the availability of fossil fuels. And so the top priority is to reduce and then eliminate fossil fuel use over the next 30 years. We need to reduce carbon emissions by 70 pounds per person per year every year for the next 30 years. This approach will result in two achievements. The first is that in 30 years, there will be zero fossil fuel use. The second is that possibly the planet will be saved and able to recover. It is proposed that each consecutive fossil fuel production year be reduced by 23.9% of the previous year's total production. This will achieve zero fossil fuel production in 30 years. Any fossil fuel company producing in excess of this reduced amount will be taxed 23.9% of its total production value for that year. Another priority is the reduction of the planet's human population from 7 billion to 48 million. This can be done by the altruistic act of voluntary zero births through contraception, except for a select group of humans who will act as our seed for generations to come. And I propose that this group of humans be those who are already practicing the right stuff, such as the hunter-gatherer tribes that live hidden in the remote deserts and jungles, because they have figured out the right way to live. it is proposed that every non-hunter-gatherer birth be taxed at 1 year's salary of the parents. To save the Earth as a whole, we need to forget about capitalism, macro and microeconomics, and sustainability. We need to take ourselves from a species that thinks the world of itself and that all other species are subservient to it, to a species that says, I am no better or less than any other species on Earth, that I am a participant and not the director or owner of life on Earth. A moment of silence ensued, broken by a loud blasphemy coming from the rear of the room as a neatly dressed man with a black bow tie stood up, holding an open Bible in his hand. Verse 28 of Genesis says, And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. What do you say to the word of God that contradicts what you just said? Alex then fell silent and looked out for reactions on the faces of his audience, then asked, Anyone want to respond to this gentleman? The silence continued for a few moments. Alex then said, The gentleman with the black bow tie is right. While God said I am to have dominion over the earth, I say that I should not have such power. You see, God made us in his image, but not with his wisdom, and there are issues he left up to us to solve. As a result, our judgments have directed us onto a dangerous path on Earth, which is leading to disaster. We are consuming the Earth faster than she can replenish herself. We must stop what we're doing and try to reverse the damage we have already done. Thus, we need to abstain from the use of fossil fuel, renounce capitalism, and reduce our population size to a level that the Earth can manage. Next chapter. Title: Benefits of the Hunter-Gatherer Nomad Lifestyles. This was the third presentation in the series of lectures. Alex summarized the first two lectures and then said, At last count, there were less than 2 million hunter-gatherer nomads on Earth. So there is a vacancy sign up that says 46 million hunter-gatherer nomads wanted. But I need to regress. There is no habitat for those 46 million tribesmen and women because it is long gone, thanks to the advent of civilization. What I can say is if we adopt the recommended plan of action presented in this series of presentations, namely elimination of fossil fuel use and reducing the population count, then there will be amply restored habitat for 46 million more hunter-gatherers over the next 30 years or so. If we can accomplish the goals in this series of lectures, then the wanted signs for hunter-gatherers will pop up. How do you feel about giving up your current lifestyle for that of the hunter-gatherer? The room was silent. Surely, we would all be upset, he said. No one likes changes in their lives, especially that drastic a change from driving a car or sitting in a cubicle at work, banging on a computer, returning home to the major meal of the day, then relaxing in front of the TV. Isn't that right, miss? He pointed to a lady in the front row. The lady giggled, hiding her embarrassment. For example, we would not need a car, continues Alex. We would have a territory that can be traversed by foot. Now is that bad or good? We would not have a confining cubicle, but the whole territory would be our workshop, and instead of banging on a computer, we would be perfecting our techniques in spear making and so forth. We would be making and having our meals with the whole family. That would include grandparents, aunts, and uncles. Then retire to the fireplace, where we would make up our own stories based on events of the day or reiterate old legends for entertainment. You see, our lives would not be that much different as a whole. Only the details would be different. Is there anybody who would agree or disagree with that statement? Asked Alex of the audience. A couple of hands were raised, and he picked one. With all due respect, Mr. Alex, but aren't you talking about savages? Asked a voice from the audience. Well, I would not call them savages at all. For example, the tribes I have studied had rules of conduct, a belief system, and generally a happy lifestyle. The idea of them being savages comes from old movies and books written by people who did not understand, and the main business of whom was to make money, responded Alex. More recent books and documentaries by anthropologists like Margaret Mead and others paint a different picture of hunter-gatherers, continued Alex. No, they don't put white people in large pots and cook them for dinner, nor do they drag women by their hair into dark caves. There are many benefits to the hunter-gatherer lifestyle, added Alex. As hunter-gatherers, we will hunt and gather around where we live, so we do not have to leave the home base or be away from family and friends. Hunting and gathering takes about 2 to 4 hours a day, and all the food is fresh. With a short workday, we have abundant leisure time to be with family and friends around the campfire. The elderly spend their days not alone, but as a part of the group they had lived with. Hunters and gatherers are always physically fit, and there is no problem of excess body weight. Because hunter-gatherers require large areas as their territories, we won't suffer from the sedentary lifestyle diseases of civilization. To summarize a few more points, Alex flips a page on a flip chart that displays the following. Because we won't have any possessions, we will have no worries about anyone stealing. Men get to exercise their instincts for hunting and fishing. Men and women get to exercise all their instincts for living. Get rid of the stress of modern life. Enjoy personal satisfaction that each one of us will be living an earth-sustainable lifestyle that will last for thousands, if not millions, of generations to come. Live a more energy-efficient lifestyle. Only when we live this simple life will we sway to the music and join the rest of the biota in the dance of life again. So praise the sun and mother, Earth, because we are their precious children, one and all. Alex concluded his lecture. Before you go, he added, pick up the flyer entitled Nature and Human Survival by Maggie Smith that is on the table next to the door. Next chapter. Title: Rules of the Hunter-Gatherer Nomad Lifestyles. Alex entered the conference room at the library about a minute or two late, apologized for his tardiness, and jumped right into the subject. He said, "Who here believes that the hunter-gatherer nomads of the world have no rules to live by?" Almost all hands went up in the air, indicating they believed that the hunter-gatherer nomads don't. "What if I told you that they do?" said Alex. "Their cultures embody their rules, and it may not be obvious to the first-time observer that that is so. For example, all tribes obey the rule that a brother does not marry his sister," continued Alex. "Their rules are not written down in books, but expressed in their rituals, mores, beliefs, and activities, such as hunting, eating, music, and the stories they tell near the campfire at night. We therefore should cover and document here the rules under which we need to live and thrive, and let these rules guide us in a new belief system and new behaviors," added Alex. "The first thing is our attitude. We must become wise to the fact and consider ourselves a part and not apart from the living cycles, the web, and the biota on Earth. Notions like humans are at the top of the food chain, and humans have superior intelligence, have continuously crept into everyday talk and literature as an expression of our naturally blind drive to acquire more. Humans are not at the top of the food chain, but they are a link no better or worse than any other link, be it a pile of leaves or another species in the web of life. Second, each one of us must identify our living environment. It is the environment of the omnivore, or those who consume plant and animal matter for sustenance, and leave behind only the waste of plant and animal matter for our brethren who use it for their sustenance. Third, we must not ingest or consume anything that did not originate from our local living environment. That means we must not ingest anything processed, manufactured, or imported, because this kind of nutrition only returns us into the endless loop of self-destruction. We must thank our sources of food, earth, and the sun, because they are the providers. Fourth, we must not leave behind anything that can't be consumed by those who are next in line in our local living environment. Fifth, we must not use implements that do not come from our local living environment. We can use anything that occurs naturally, such as local stones, tree branches, leaves, and the like. "You mean we wouldn't be any better than an ugly roach crawling in the sewers?" asked the man with the large bandage on his head. "Well, I would not call a cockroach ugly, since I have studied them in the lab and have gained an appreciation for their function in the world. For humans, cockroaches pose little threat. practically all species of cockroaches are beneficial to their environment, and they are an invaluable aid in recycling a large majority of the Earth's dead or decaying plant and animal matter, responded Alex. As for sewers, there will be no need for them if we were hunter-gatherer nomadic tribes. So I think your argument is moot, sir. In the back of the room, a hand was raised. Yes, motioned Alex for the lady to stand up. What is your question, miss? He asked. I'm Mrs. Dorothy Slazenger, and I was wondering if you practice what you preach. For example, you don't live the life of a hunter-gatherer, do you? No, I don't, replied Alex. Then that makes you a hypocrite, doesn't it? She added. I suppose it does seem like it, but I have good reason to live like all you do in a comfortable house with three squares on the table and a car. I did contemplate at one time becoming a true hunter-gatherer out in the Amazon jungle, but there were several reasons I didn't. On one hand, I would not survive a day out there in a true jungle, for I am not equipped for it physically or mentally. I would not know, for example, how to hunt for a meal and would die in a matter of days. In another way, I would be taking up the place of a hunter-gatherer who knows how to hunt and live out there. In other words, I would be taking resources away from the tribes that are out there now. Finally, I would not have the opportunity to give this presentation to you if I was a hunter-gatherer out there in the Amazon rainforest, for this exhibition is meant for us so-called civilized people. Next chapter presentation to you. Action plans. In this fifth lecture, Alex starts by summarizing the goals already mentioned previously, namely, zero birth rates and elimination of non-indigenous fuel use. To achieve zero impact on the environment, I need to ask each one of you to be the ultimate altruist, which is a noble and much revered act of giving and sacrifice for the well-being of others. No religion or belief system speaks highly of the selfless act of giving without regard to one's benefit or safety. First, we need to do all we can to protect and respect all hunter-gatherer nomadic tribes of the world, for they are the hope of humanity and the earth. They are the ones who know and practice the zero-footprint lifestyle at present. It is they who will lead humanity to save the earth. Those tribes who have been contacted by us are to be our guides to the new earth, and those who have not been contacted, of whom there are approximately 100 tribes left around the world, are to be protected from our greediness and left alone to flourish. Second, we need to reduce the number of humans on Earth to approximately 48 million. So the first action that needs to be taken is zero human population birth rate for those who are not hunter-gatherers. It is proposed that every birth is to be taxed at 1 year's salary of the parents. Third, we need to eliminate the use of non-indigenous fuels. The aim is to reduce them to zero in 30 years. It is proposed that each consecutive fuel production year be reduced by 23.9% of the previous year's total production. This will achieve zero non-indigenous fuel production in 30 years. Any fuel company producing in excess of this reduced amount will be taxed 23.9% of its total production value for that year. Fourth is a new education system. Education is the oracle for the future. Without it, we are sailing on a ship with no compass. This education must be one of integrity and not based on alternative facts. It must rest upon the truth and not political aspirations. It must emanate from those who dedicate their lives to the pursuit of the scientific method and not the consensus of the masses. It is true the scientific community is struggling in the wake of the revival of faith-based political activists who want to protect the status quo and change things to the way they were in the nostalgic past. Unfortunately, that is like having the kidneys dictating the judgments of the brain. What should be happening is that decisions be made based on our scientifically evaluated information. That is the way nature intended it to be. All species on Earth have an information system based on knowledge. Single-celled species have a genetically based information system that was honed by experience over millions of years. More complex species require a central nervous system for gathering information and making decisions in a shorter time frame. The more complex species, like humans, have a brain that receives external and internal evidence to make timely choices on how they should respond. The more accurate the incoming data, the better the resultant actions. To the human species, the scientific method is currently the only approach to understanding the truth of nature, as opposed to the consensus of the masses that only yields mediocrity. Governments should consist of meek men of science, 45 years old, serving 2 years each as conscripts with a modest salary. Only then can the human species move in the required direction of zero ecological footprint, restoring the cyclical nature of life on Earth, and becoming efficient energy users once again. For example, in the United States of America, the Constitution should be changed so that all House representatives, senators, and the president should be replaced by such scientists. The tasks before these scientist rulers are to educate the public in the upcoming dark 30 years, preparing them for almost zero births and zero fossil fuel use. Of course, the reason why all these changes need to occur has to be loud and clear. The public must be involved and engaged on a global scale. The above are my proposed action plans to save the planet. What are yours? Asked Alex of his audience, but the room fell silent. He went on, Now is the time we should start being efficient catalysts and rejoin the rest of the biota, claiming our equitable allotment of the sun's blessing. Now is the time we start achieving zero harm to the environment and nestle back in with our brothers and sisters for a long-term future. Now is the time to wholeheartedly rejoin the symphony of life on Earth and dance in glory with all the rest of the living. The audience rose and clapped vigorously, except for Officer Chris Snipe, who was busily taking down notes. Next chapter. Title: The Resistance. Captain Al Marvin put down the phone, and Officer Chris Snipe continued his conversation. As I was saying, sir, Alexandros Panzaris is advocating the overthrow of the U.S. government and replacing it with a group of scientific nuts. Did he advocate the armed overthrow of the government? Asked the captain. No, he didn't go over that part, but I don't know of any other way of doing it, sir, responded Chris. Besides, there were other people like him in the conference room at the public library who could very well do so. What do you propose to do about this Panzaris guy? Asked the captain. We need to cut the snake's head off before it grows and does harm, replied Chris. Very well. Do you need any assistance? Asked the captain. I will need an abduction crew, replied Chris. Next chapter. Title: The Message. Alex was walking Saturday morning toward the coffee shop for his morning joe before he headed to the library to rehearse the last of 6 sessions he was to present on the following Monday when a black van stopped in front of him. 3 masked men jumped out, shoved a gray sack over his head, and pushed him into the van that raced off. He was placed in a jail cell somewhere in New York City. He surmised from the conversations of the guards that his time was limited. One day, a guard asked him if he had any last wishes, and Alex requested a pen and paper to write on. He wrote a note to Maggie expressing his love for her and thanking her for standing by his side, contributing to the mission he was meant to carry out. He reminisced about the days they spent together in Cairo and Oxford, their tender moments and other joyful times, their courtship. He tells her that his time is up. The current global culture is protecting itself from his radical ideas, but that he would not have done it any differently. He told her to go to Ismail and make a life with him, for he was a good man, as a teardrop fell onto the paper. Alex folded the paper over and wrote their home address on the backside. He then whispered to Chuck, the guard, to come over. He handed the guard the note and asked him to mail it as his last request. The guard took the note and said, okay. Chuck read the note, chuckled, then crumpled it up and threw it in the wastebasket as Alex watched. Alex then wrote down his poem. Like all the nomads before me who made tracks across the vast expanses of endless deserts, I search for the oasis where all can be quenched with sweet waters of wisdom. And if you ask me if I will reach that oasis in my lifetime, I will say it doesn't matter. Pregnant Maggie was folding laundry in the family room one morning when she noticed a string of familiar words that said, Like all the nomads before me who made tracks across the vast expanses of endless deserts, I search for the oasis where all can be quenched with sweet waters of wisdom. And if you ask me if I will reach that oasis in my lifetime. Recognizing they were from Alex's poem, she started to pay attention to the host reading the news on TV. Was found in the mouth of the deceased who committed suicide off of the Empire State Building. Anybody who recognizes this poem is to contact the New York Police Department at the toll-free number 1-800-555-4563. Maggie immediately called Alex's hotel and asked to ring room 212, but the gentleman at the hotel desk said Alex had checked out 2 days before. In a panic, Maggie phoned Ismail. Have you heard anything from Alex since yesterday? No, I haven't. Why? What's the matter? He asked. Fear started to worm its way into her consciousness. I called the hotel where he was staying, and they said he checked out the day before yesterday. She responded with her hand now shaking as it held the phone. He didn't tell me he was coming home so early. He has one more presentation to give. Her lips started to tremble. He shouldn't have checked out of the hotel until tomorrow. Stay calm now, Maggie. I am sure there is a logical explanation as to why he checked out of the hotel. Maybe he found better accommodations elsewhere. Stay where you are, and I will try to find out where he is. Maggie tried everything to keep calm, but it was not working. Teardrops started to roll down her cheeks. Morning turned into evening when Ismail called with no news of Alex. I tried everything, and I just can't find him. Maggie called the police to inform them that the man who jumped or fell to his death in New York City was Alexandros Panzaris. Monday arrived, and it was decided that Ismail take over the last concluding presentation. He walked into the library's conference room a few minutes late and introduced himself as Alex's assistant, who was to give this final presentation in Alex's unavoidable absence. He started and said, "The human species evolved to coexist with its natural, organic, and inorganic environments in the most energy-efficient way. This efficiency translated into an easy lifestyle of hunting, foraging, playing, singing, dancing, and socializing, a lifestyle that recognized their oneness with the said environment, an environment that can only be called Eden and reaffirmed in their belief systems. One day, a magical lamp was discovered that, when rubbed, a genie would appear granting wishes of prosperity. Within 200 years, industrial capitalism was born, which cleared most of the global landmass of native animal and plant species, built cities with skyscrapers, and scraped the ground for minerals and metals, while reaching for the stars. The achievements of humans are impressive, but they increased energy consumption by 24,000 times per individual. When comparing total global populations from the original hunter-gatherer to modern humans, energy consumption increased by 3,600,000 times. Our colossal consumption of energy facilitated the creation of material wealth. Unlike some thinkers, this wealth was not created from thin air, but from the Earth's organic and inorganic resources. Furthermore, many of these resources can't be replaced or replenished, for the Earth is finite. Today, we are much less efficient in the utilization of energy compared to the hunter-gatherers who came before us. In addition, we have grown increasingly estranged from our natural place in the environment, which has been pretty much eradicated. As a result, we have been increasingly alienated from a belief system that humans are an integral part of their natural environment. Alienated from a belief system that explained the mystery of the unknown with images of the known and imagined. Alienated from a belief system that worshipped the Earth-Sun marriage and its powers of renewal. Alex planned to try to put the genie back into the magical lamp and reverse what has happened to Earth in the past 200 years under the false god of capitalism. He proposed that we first protect the currenter gatherers from further annihilation, letting them seed our future with the right stuff, and for the rest of us to perform the ultimate act of altruism. Title: Brian Nally. With Alex's note to Maggie crumpled up in the wastebasket and out of Maggie's reach, she had to decide on her own. She was now incubating Alex's child, and she knew she needed a supportive companion to be the father figure. She first turned to Ismail, whom she loved dearly and who she thought would agree to be the father figure. But Ismail thought it would be too great of an altruistic act for him to carry out, even though it was for the child of his best friend. The laboratory where Maggie was working was involved in research on the causes of sterile sperm in beef cattle, where she was the lead researcher. They were able to isolate a virus that caused this affliction and called it A832. Maggie wrote an article on A832 in the Oregon Cattleman's Journal, which caught the eye of a well-to-do cattle rancher named Brian Nally. Brian was so impressed by Maggie and her team's research that he wanted to create his laboratory at the ranch for the research into cattle diseases. He offered Maggie and the team double their salaries if they came to work for him. This was a big to-do for her team, and they all jumped at the opportunity. However, Maggie reminded them that they are in the middle of other research projects, and besides, working for a driven boss is different than working at a liberal science university like Oregon State University. However, the team asked Maggie to look into making this opportunity happen. So, she approached the head of the department with the news and started to negotiate with them on moving the laboratory to the Nally Ranch. She also started negotiations with Brian Nally in setting up the laboratory and its culture to support the team. The department head, Dr. Pat Josepola, tried his best to discourage the move, while Brian insisted that they adopt his authoritarian role as head of the ranch. In the end, the whole idea fell apart, and things returned to normal for the team that did not want to work in a ranch-style authoritarian environment. But all was not lost. The negotiations lasted 8 weeks, and in that time, Maggie and Brian met several times in social settings and gradually became intimate. Brian proposed marriage to Maggie a month later, and she accepted. She now had a companion whom her child could call father. Next chapter. Title: The Crash. A year later, Brian Nally was in Argentina on business looking into purchasing some disease-resistant cattle, and Maggie was on her way to meet him. Flight 34492 lost power and altitude on its way to Argentina. It started to clip the tops of trees on its way through the Brazilian airspace in a thunderstorm. Suddenly, it spun around, clipped a larger tree in its way, and caught fire. First, the right engine lit up the jungle with an explosion, then its belly rumbled as it broke open, pouring out more fuel. The broken fuselage came to rest on the jungle floor after both wings were torn off. The fires were put out by the rain soon thereafter. All that could be heard were the raindrops hitting the foliage, the rush of small streamlets that were forming among the humus and leaves on the ground, and the faint cry of a baby strapped into a bassinet hanging off of one of the bulkheads. All other individuals were motionless, some belted into their seats and others randomly scattered around the cabin. All were bloodied by the ordeal. A few hours later, a loud woman's scream came from the plane. By that time, a few passengers were moving around. The scream came from a young mother near the bassinet where the baby was lying. "My baby, where is my Alex?" She screamed again and again. A rescue team was organized at Castalia Airport, about 75 miles from the crash site, and flown in by helicopters to a clearing atop a hill about a mile away. After those who were still alive were rescued and the recovery of those who were not, a search for the missing baby started and ended 2 weeks later. The search covered 1 square mile along the path of the falling plane and found no trace of Alex Jr. Maggie kept begging for the search to continue, but the head of the rescue team told her that the probability of finding her son alive was less than 1 in a million, and he could not see endangering his crew by continuing. Maggie was met by her husband Brian Nally at the search site, who came in with the rescue crew. He tried to console her as he fought his tears, but they both had to return to an empty nest in Sweet Home, Oregon. Next chapter. Title: Maggie. Alex Jr.'s gravesite was next to his grandmother's. She died of grief 3 years after the crash. Maggie was just out of college, where she got a doctorate in anthropology. Brian was an exemplary husband to her. Alex Jr.'s gravesite was erected to put the tragedy behind them and for Maggie to try to find closure. In the mind of Maggie, however, always thought that Alex Jr. was still alive. Her wishes were granted, and there was only a birth date chiseled onto his tombstone. Maggie fantasized that she would go back to the scene of the crash and find her son waiting for her. One day, she realized she could make her dreams a reality. she decided to go back to the Brazilian jungle and search for Alex Jr. She knew she could not make it on her own. Brian, a former special ops captain, would not help, calling it a waste of time and money. She turned to Ismail. After wilderness survival training and purchasing the required gear, both Ismail and Maggie took off on a flight to Brazil the following summer, landing in the capital, Brasilia. From there, they chartered a plane to Castalia, where they hired a guide and a helicopter that took them to the crash site. It was now overgrown, and they essentially had to feel their way to find the wreckage. The helicopter pilot was instructed to pick them up and return them to Castalia in a month. Ismail surmised they could not do more than what the search party had done earlier, and so he decided to act as a hunter who stays in one spot waiting for the prey to wander to him. They pitched their tents and waited for something to happen. They were hoping that a hunter-gatherer tribe close by would stumble onto their location, at which point they would inquire about the existence of a white boy somewhere in the vicinity. Next chapter. Title: Boots. A week passed by with no results. Ismail was well aware of the dangers involved in their search and explained them to Maggie. Any given culture protects the patents of their successful way of life, rejecting any challenges or modifications from the outside. With the heat and the campfire smell permeating her clothes, Maggie decided to clean up. She asked their guide to find her a spot where she could bathe. While he was gone, she told Ismail what she was about to do, and he suggested that she keep her boots on for protection. After the guide returned to tell her where the best place to bathe was, she took off in that direction. Approximately half an hour later, Ismail stood up and reached for his rifle after hearing the rustling of leaves and branches close by, and he suddenly fell to the ground with an arrow sticking out from his shoulder. Meanwhile, Maggie had taken off her clothes near a marshy pond approximately 300 yards from the campsite, and as she took her first plunge into the pond, she noticed she was not alone. The pond was surrounded by a group of natives pointing right at her. She tried to cover herself with her hands and arms, but it was not enough. She turned around and started to run towards where she had hung her clothes on the branches of a bush, but all she could see were her panties that suddenly also disappeared, followed by an outburst of laughter and giggles from behind them. As she stood there trying to figure out what to do, she felt a nudge in the nape of her back, and she realized that she was being ushered forward by an old man. When they reached a narrow path, she saw an older woman waiting for her. "Imshi waraya," said the old woman, and she proceeded down the path, waving Maggie to follow her. Maggie followed, trying to hide her private parts with her hands from the gaze of the row of five tribesmen following them. The tribespeople were all naked, except for a few wearing loincloths. As Maggie walked, she felt more comfortable being around these naked people and gradually let down her arms. They all reached a small clearing in the jungle, with small huts scattered around in no particular fashion. The older woman stopped and said, "Inti hatibni kokik hina," as she pointed to the ground. Maggie did not know what to do, so she pointed to the ground too. "Talo hina, yabanat sado el siti," said the older woman, as she looked at a small group of girls who were starting to reach out to touch Maggie's white, supple skin. The young women cut branches that were then bent and twisted to make the frame of a hut. The girls went around picking large leaves that were then intertwined with the branches, and more leaves were placed on top of the hut to make it waterproof. The whole operation took about half an hour to complete, and just as they finished, a group of men came carrying the delirious Ismail to Maggie's hut, and the older woman said, "Inti hatakti balik min rugolik," and the men placed Ismail in Maggie's hut. Maggie rushed right in to see how he was doing. The arrow had been removed, and all that was left was a gaping hole in his shoulder that was covered by some type of blue-green leaves. She yanked the leaves from the wound. As the older woman entered the hut and saw what Maggie had done, she yelled at her and said, "CBL Warak Matraho," and she placed the leaves back on the wound. From her actions, Maggie surmised that the leaves were medicinal. Just then, Ismail regained consciousness and looked around the hut, spotting Maggie. "Girl," I thought I told you to keep your boots on. Maggie and Ismail were pretty much left alone the rest of the day. They contemplated what would happen to them next and considered escaping, but did not know where to escape. Ismail thought they could make it back to their campsite, but Maggie whispered, "We will be right back where we started, and the helicopter isn't due for another 2 weeks." A small girl came to their hut as they stood outside and gave them what looked like a small pig that was on the fire for a while in a leaf with some white dough on it. She motioned that they should eat. By that time, they were hungry and would eat anything, but this carcass and dough were too much to swallow. Ismail tried the pig and encouraged Maggie to try some, but she turned her head. Next chapter. Title: The Search. The helicopter crew landed on the appointed date 3 weeks later and found Maggie and Ismail's camp deserted. They stuck around yelling their names frequently, listening for a response, but none came. As dusk approached, they took off back to Castalia Airport and reported Maggie and Ismail as missing. The authorities decided to send out a search and rescue party to bring them back. They also informed Brian, Maggie's husband, of the situation, and he hightailed it out to the campsite within 4 days. The search party spent 2 weeks penetrating the dense jungle in an area of about a square mile around the crash site, but found no one. All they found were Maggie's clothes near a pond, blood in the campsite, and the rest of the camp gear. The search also yielded evidence of a hunter-gatherer tribe's campsite in a clearing. All that was left were decaying huts and cold campfires. The imagination of the searchers went wild with speculation as to what happened to the two. One theory was that they were eaten by the hunter-gatherers. The search didn't go well for one person who was bitten by a snake and flown to Castalia Airport. He was pronounced dead on arrival. Brian pleaded with the leader of the search party to extend the search one more week, but failed. The leader called off the search at the end of 2 weeks and all retreated to Castalia Airport. Next chapter. Title: Alex Jr. Soon thereafter, a deluge of rain dropped down on them, and they had to take cover in the hut. They stayed there until the jungle started to get dark, and the sounds of the natives started to pick up a rhythm. Maggie stuck her head outside and saw the tribe gathering around a central campfire. Both Maggie and Ismail sat outside their hut watching what was going on. First, the tribe adults stood in a large circle around the campfire, as a young girl crawled from one side of the circle to the center close to the fire. Then a young boy with leaves tied to his flapping arms approached the girl and fed her with his mouth what Maggie thought was a fig. More young kids joined them, some with masks resembling animals, others resembling trees. The children interlocked one leg to the leg of the next and started to hop in unison around the campfire. The adult members of the tribe then started to sing louder. Much later on, Maggie found out that this dance represented the story of creation, where the young girl as a salamander crawled out of the pond hungry and was met by a bird who fed her a tikwala berry and turned her into all creatures large and small. Maggie further was told that the salamander and bird were metaphors for the creation process, that the salamander crawled out of the pond of the unknown and was fed its soul. The interlocked legs of the children hopping in unison signified the interleaving of all life. After the singing was over, the tribe sat down with their children and started to discuss the events of the day. The camp was dark by now, and the only light was from the campfire flickering in the faces of the tribe's people. She was not sure whether she saw a face that was different and lighter from the rest in the circle, but she could not be sure. She leaned over to Ismail and asked if he could see anything different in the direction of what she saw, and he responded that he could not. The tribe's elders started to sing once again after the discussions waned. This time, a hollow log was used as a drum. Gradually, the crowd thinned out as people returned to their huts for the night, as did Maggie and Ismail. "I thought I saw a white face along the campfire," said Maggie. "Are you sure you are not projecting something into what you saw?" responded Ismail. "I don't know. I'm confused," she said. The next morning, they were awakened by a young girl who yelled into their hut, "Ishu," and then waited outside. As Maggie and Ismail emerged, the girl motioned for them to follow her. When they reached a long row of women and young girls holding sticks, Maggie and Ismail were given each a stick, placed at the beginning of the row, and the group started to walk forward while thrashing the vegetation as they yelled, "Hoo! Hoo!" The women also picked mushrooms and other edibles, throwing them into baskets they carried on their backs. Maggie and Ismail imitated what was happening and moved along with the women and girls. Pretty soon they could see the vegetation in front of them move as small animals scurried away. This continued for about a half hour until they reached the men who were holding onto nets. As the little animals ran into the nets, they were captured, and the men repeated the words, "Rabina Yakalikom," which meant, "Bless you. Reborn you will be." When the hunt was over, Maggie noticed out of the corner of her eye that a white boy was standing next to a muscular man. She then took a straight look at him and knew that it was her son Alex. Before she could run to him, Ismail grabbed her arm and said, "Not now, Maggie," as he too looked for acknowledgement. "Let me go," she complained as she yanked her arm away. But Ismail was quicker. He jumped down and caught her foot as she tried to run. She fell to the ground. "He doesn't know you, Maggie. You are too excited right now. You will just frighten him." On the way back, Maggie asked Ismail, "How do I approach him?" "Maybe you need to approach the man who was with him first, get acquainted, and gradually ask about Alex," answered Ismail. "What the hell are you talking about? I can't get acquainted with the man who was with Alex. I don't have a way of communicating here," she complained. "There is sign and body language. Don't underestimate the avenues of communication in this situation." When they reached their hut, Maggie crawled inside and started to think of ways to approach Alex. About a quarter of an hour later, Ismail poked his head into the hut and said, "You will not believe who is here." "Who?" she asked. "Come out and you will see for yourself." Maggie poked her head out of the hut and gasped. Alex was holding the hand of a woman. "Take it easy now, Maggie. Take it real slow," advised Ismail. She emerged from the hut smiling and looked straight at Alex Jr., holding out her hand as if to shake his, but he shied away behind the woman who clasped her right hand onto her left elbow, holding the left hand up and open and said, "Izayokom," which was the tribal greeting. Ismail caught on and did the same with his hands and repeated, "Izayokom." Both women and Alex Jr. laughed, for that was not the answer to their greeting of, "How are you?" Ismail and Maggie joined in laughing too, not knowing what to do. The woman said, "Intom trudo, asan minokom." After about 10 minutes of repetition and a few signs, Maggie and Ismail understood that "asan minokom" translated to "better than you are doing," and was the answer to the tribe's greeting. They also found out that Alex had a tribal name of Mbutu, and his mother's name was Zanuba. This little episode broke the ice in their relationship, and all concerned acknowledged that they will have a lot of learning to do to communicate a bit more effectively. As the days passed by and their words back and forth became better understood, it was found out that it was Alex Jr.'s idea to approach the new people in the camp since they were white. It was also understood that the woman with Alex Jr. and the man teaching him to hunt were his parents. After a year in the jungle, the kinship of being white people in Alex Jr.'s life was not enough for Maggie. She needed to let them know that she was his biological mother. She needed to consummate the bondage she had with him before the plane crash and losing him. Ismail could see the pain in her eyes every time she saw Alex, and he was trying to think of a plan to break the news to Alex and his now parents. One day, Maggie was asked by Alex's tribal mother if she had children with Ismail. "Yes," she lied. "We have a son whom we lost in this jungle 11 years ago." Since the tribe had no calendar or seasons to speak of, Mbutu's mother, Zanuba, did not know what was meant by 11 years ago. But she did know what was meant by a lost child. "How did you lose your child?" Mbutu's mother asked. Maggie paused a while thinking about how to say the next sentence, then said, "I was riding on a large bird in the sky, and it fell in this jungle a long time ago. It was then that I lost my child, boy." Mbutu's mother was silent for a minute, and then she started to scream at Maggie while shielding Mbutu from her. Zanuba realized that her son Mbutu was the son of Maggie and felt threatened by Maggie, who naturally would want to take Mbutu away from her. This startled Maggie, who realized the graveness of the situation and tried to calm Zanuba down. But Zanuba kept on shouting and yelling at Maggie while a crowd of tribal members gathered around them. Ismail came running. Maggie told Ismail, Zanuba found out Mbutu was her son. Someone in the crowd said something that quieted Zanuba. A man approached both Maggie and Zanuba, taking them by their arms to a hut in the middle of the campsite, and said something to whomever was inside. After a minute of silence, an old man came out of the hut and talked for about 30 seconds. The man who brought Zanuba and Maggie to him talked for another 20 seconds or so. The old man was the eldest of the tribe and considered wise. He talked to the gathered crowd and then to Maggie and Zanuba. He then looked at Mbutu, who was standing behind Zanuba, and motioned for him to come forward, which he did. The wise man talked to Mbutu for a few seconds and then fell silent. Mbutu looked at both Zanuba, then Maggie, and eventually walked over to Zanuba, indicating he would rather stay with her. Maggie was hurt by his decision, but she kept a straight face and then smiled, indicating to Alex that it was okay, and her relationship with Zanuba and Alex returned to normal again. About a month later, Zanuba brought Alex to Maggie and said, "Kude inti hoa ibnik." Alex then went over to Maggie and held her hand as Zanuba walked away. It was disclosed that Zanuba had second thoughts about keeping Mbutu away from Maggie. She had two other children of her own, and Maggie had only Mbutu. The relationship between Maggie and Alex grew stronger as the months passed, and at one point, Maggie and Ismail thought of returning with Alex to Oregon. They told Zanuba what their plan was, and she seemed okay with it, kind of resigned to it. In their travels with the tribe from one hunting area to another, they noticed a river in the area, and so they decided to build a raft and float downriver to any town that had transportation out of the jungle. It took approximately 20 days to construct the raft, after which the three of them took off downriver. They traveled for half a day and then parked on shore to go hunting or fishing. Nights were spent on the parked raft. They took turns sleeping because one person had to keep an ear and eye out for danger. After 11 days, they reached a small logging village. Maggie took Ismail's shirt to wear while he kept his shorts on as the three of them ventured in to meet the inhabitants. They were lucky in that the manager of the logging company was there checking on the condition of the logging trucks and knew English. Ismail explained to him their ordeal and asked if they could have a ride out to the nearest airport, and he agreed. As the time to board the truck came and they approached it, Alex wanted to flee back into the jungle, for he had seen the company manager being swallowed by the beast. Maggie explained to him that it was not a beast, but a truck for transportation. She then asked the company manager to get out of the truck to show Alex that he wasn't swallowed. The road was pretty much through clear-cut areas of the once lush jungle. Alex was having a hard time with his vision, for he wasn't used to wide-open spaces and could not comprehend what depth perception was. For example, once a horse was standing about 500 yards away from the truck, and he thought it was a bug on the windshield. Next chapter. Title: Oregon. They were dropped off in the city of Castalia, where they went around asking for money and collected enough for a meal and a change of modest clothing. They then walked to the airport and met with the head of the rescue team, who helped them connect with Maggie's husband, Brian. After the three of them managed to get into the flying machine, Brian met them at the Eugene Airport with open arms 3 days later. Alex Jr. was having a hard time adjusting and hung on to Maggie's arm the whole time because everyone outside his tribe was a potential enemy. Since he was only 11 years old, in a completely foreign environment with different smells, lighting, sounds, and languages, he felt he needed protection and reassurance. Brian Nally owned a large ranch near the town of Sweet Home that he didn't work himself, but had a manager and crew that did. The ranch business consisted of cattle that needed to be rounded up seasonally and moved. The cattle were eventually sold at auction. He had his stock of breeding cattle that was kept separate from the rest of the herd. Alex was taken up to his room in what was called the Big House and he stayed there for about a week simply because he was too frightened. He wouldn't even go down to eat with Brian, Maggie, and farm manager, Bill. On the second day, Maggie took meat and potato dishes enough for two up to his room, sat on the floor, and started to eat and encouraged Alex to do the same. More often than not, he would spit or vomit it up again. After 2 days of this behavior, Maggie went to the grocery store and bought vegetables, nuts, berries, and mushrooms that she thought he might be able to keep down. She also visited a local rabbit farm and bought some for him to eat. At the big house, she prepared a rabbit the way they did in the wild by roasting it whole, less the innards, until the fur and skin were pretty much gone, filling the kitchen with the smell of burnt hair. These ingredients and cooking methods turned out more palatable to Alex. He even felt better and slept on top of the bed instead of in the closet during the night. He gathered a few rabbit bones and buried them under the bed as he sang the Rambuti song. In the second week, he was introduced to the clothing that he needed to wear to be civil around the farm instead of his loincloth. Maggie started him out with a pair of shorts that bothered him at first, but eventually got used to them. Next came sandals and eventually a t-shirt. Now, Alex spent most of his nights singing the songs he sang with his tribe back in the Amazon jungle. Sometimes they got to be loud, waking Brian up in alarm as he reached for the handgun that lay under his pillow. "Oh, put that darn thing away, Brian," said Maggie one night. Brian didn't have Maggie's patience and kept saying things like, "You need to be assertive with him, like riding a bucking horse. You ride, ride, and ride him until you break him into the new reality, the here and now, and not dilly-dally around. That's for the birds." One morning, as Brian and Maggie were having breakfast, they noticed Alex coming down the stairs taking slow steps. It seemed he was venturing around the big house. "Come here, boy," yelled Brian, but Alex didn't understand those words. Maggie then spoke up and said, "Alex, come to me," and motioned with her hand for him to approach her. As he fought with his crotch, Alex walked up to Maggie and said, "Saba el Kir," which was his tribal morning greeting. "Oh, fiddlesticks? You mean you haven't taught him English yet?" exclaimed Brian. As Alex became more familiar with the big house, he one day asked Maggie what the big white box was for in the kitchen. It turned out to be the refrigerator, and Maggie opened it up and showed him all the food and drink that was in it. "Why does it not stink?" he asked. "It is because it is a cold box, and cold food does not spoil," she said as she placed his hand on one of the refrigerator shelves. Alex pulled it away quickly. He had never experienced cold before. "But why do you have a cold box in the kitchen?" Alex inquired. "So we don't have to go hunting all the time," answered Maggie. "No hunting? How do you get food then?" he probed. "We no longer hunt for food, but we possess animals that we grow and eat," she responded. "What is the word possess?" he queried. She retorted, "It is hard to explain. It is like your bow and arrows you had to leave at the airport. They are things that you call your own." "How can you call an animal your own when it belongs to Gaba?" he asked. She responded, "Here in Oregon, we own our animals, and they do not belong to the forest." "So, who do you give thanks to for the animal you kill and eat?" Alex asked. "Here on the ranch, we give thanks to God, for he has given us the animals and plants to do with as we please. We trade, take care, and we eat them." Alex fell silent and looked down at the floor. That night, Alex didn't feel right. He felt that Maggie and Brian were doing something wrong by eating and not giving thanks to Gaba, which he had been doing during his singing. So, he decided to teach them the Gaba thank you song the next morning. As he started to sing, Brian would have no part of it and threw the newspaper at Alex as they sat at the breakfast table and said, "He first can't eat with utensils, and now he sings at the table." Maggie immediately stood up and yelled at Brian for treating Alex so callously, went over to Alex to console him, and explained that we can't sing when food is being served. Alex started to feel threatened and ran up to his room, hid in the closet, and would not come out for 2 days. Meanwhile, Maggie interrupted Brian while he was watching a football game on TV and said, "You know, Brian, Alex comes from a very simple lifestyle and is trying his best to adjust to our many rules. He just does what comes naturally to him." "Well, that is fine and dandy, but he needs to adjust a little faster around here. I didn't build this ranch by singing and dancing now, did I? It takes hard work and following the straight and narrow, you know, responded Brian. Yes, I know, but you will have to consider that he may not turn out to be as strong and hardworking as you. Next chapter. Title? It's complicated. Maggie brought out the vacuum cleaner and started to clean Alex's room. As she pushed the vacuum under the bed, the hose started to shake. The vacuum went clank, clank, and stopped. She opened the filter canister and found a few jammed rabbit bones. Alex at the time was in the bathroom across the hall, so she went and got him, explaining that he should not place the rabbit bones under the bed. But how do rabbits come back every day to be eaten if I don't bury their bones and sing the Rumbuti song? He asked. You don't have to bury rabbit bones here in Oregon to eat rabbit every day, nor sing the Rumbuti song, she responded. Why? He inquired. Maggie grabbed his hand and took him out of his room, down the stairs, through the front door, and to the rabbit pen in the back of the big house, and said, Here, you see we have many rabbits for you to eat. Where did they come from? He asked. I bought them from a local rabbit farmer, she replied. Where did he get them from? He asked. I don't know exactly, she replied. I suppose he breeds them or buys them from somewhere. It's complicated, she added. I know where they came from, he said. Where, Alex? She asked. From Gaba, he replied. Yes, Alex, from the jungle, she replied as she gave in. The ranch was in a wide open space which made Alex uncomfortable. Where are the trees? He asked. Oh, they were all cut down to make room for planting hay, she responded. Where then is your livelihood? It's, right here in the ranch. How can you have a livelihood without trees? He exclaimed. Maggie scratched her head and said, It is complicated. Alex looked around and noticed a bug-like thing flying slowly behind Maggie. He pointed at it and asked, What kind of a hashara is that, Maggie? Maggie looked behind her, couldn't see a bug, but did notice a tractor going down the road, and realized that because of Alex's lack of depth perception, he mistook it for something much smaller and closer. That is called a tractor, Alex. It is used to plow the fields you see over there and plant hay for the cattle. She pointed to the large expanse of open space behind the tractor. There was another tractor nearby in the barn, so Maggie decided to take Alex there to show him one up close. As they got closer, Alex grabbed Maggie's hand, tighter and tighter, seeing a bug grow so big in a very short time. As they approached, Alex was hiding behind Maggie as she touched it. Don't be scared, it will not bite. Alex moved his hand along Maggie's until he was touching the cold machine, then yanked his hand back quickly. This machine is used to dig fence post holes and drill water wells, Maggie said. Is it dead? He asked. No, it's just resting. Do you want me to wake it up? She asked. Alex nodded his head. So, Maggie got up on it, sat down, told Alex not to be frightened, and started the engine. As the diesel engine started, a billow of black smoke came out of its stack, along with the loud noise such machines make when started. Alex got the willies and ran out of the barn as fast as he could towards the big house. Maggie put the tractor in gear and drove it out of the barn to show Alex that it could move. But Alex thought the resurrected beast was coming after him, so he ran faster. Finally, Maggie stopped the tractor and turned off the engine as Alex opened the front door. Maggie followed Alex into the big house and found him in his room sitting on his bed, so she sat beside him. What does that thing do? Asked Alex. It digs post holes and water wells. Why do you have to dig for water? Exclaimed Alex. Well, we have no rivers or creeks running through the ranch, so we have to get water from the ground. Can't you get water from the rain? Inquired Alex. Yes, we can, but it is not enough to handle all the ranch's water needs. You see, we have over 500 heads of cattle that drink a lot of water. In the jungle, we never had to do anything about water except drink it, responded Alex. Why was there smoke coming out of the tractor? Asked Alex. Well, for the tractor to do anything, it has to burn fuel. What is fuel? Asked Alex. Maggie thought for a moment, then said, It is like water, except it's smelly and isn't water. Where do you get this smelly fuel? He asked. We get it from the ground, returned Maggie. Then she realized what she had just done. She just said that both water and fuel come from the ground, and she pondered how to explain that. Just then, Alex was to say something. She interrupted him and said, "It's complicated. You mentioned the word 500. What is that?" asked Alex. "It is a number, a large number," responded Maggie. "It is almost as many as the number of leaves on trees in the jungle." Alex tried to grasp this concept. He then asked, "What are cattle?" "It is an animal like a rabbit, but much, much larger," she responded. "Where are they?" he asked. Maggie responded and said, "Follow me out of the big house to the breeding stock barn." Alex hesitated. "I promise they will not harm you." So Alex took her hand once again and they walked to the barn. Alex was beyond surprised by the size of the caged heifers. He stood there thinking for a minute, imagining a tree with these beasts as leaves. "Why do you have so many of these cattle?" "That is what it takes to run a ranch like ours and support our family," replied Maggie. "Each one of these cattle can feed my whole tribe for a month. To have as many as are on a tree is way, way over what seems to me to be the needs of three people. How come?" "That is how the economy works here, to have our standard of living." "What is standard of living?" he asked. "It is to have a house, food, transportation, and things like refrigerators. I know that in the tribe's jungle, you don't need most of this, but we do. It's complicated." Next chapter. Title, Brian. As the sun retired, Brian walked into the big house at the end of a long day, washed up, and joined Maggie at the dinner table. "You wouldn't believe what Alex experienced today," exclaimed Maggie. "Where is the little squirt anyway?" asked Brian. "He had a busy day, so I fixed him something earlier and sent him up to sleep," responded Maggie. Maggie then started to fill Brian in on all that happened that day and Alex's reaction to what he saw and experienced. "Well, that is fine and dandy, but have you started the process of getting him into school?" "I'm afraid he is not ready for public school yet. He has so much to catch up on," answered Maggie. "I'm disappointed that you are not interested in Alex's experience today. It is important you know." "In what way is it important?" asks Brian. "It shows how different the two cultures are and the benefits of each," she said. "Benefits? He comes from some shithole in the Amazon, and you say there are benefits," exclaimed Brian. "Don't have a closed mind, Brian, of course. There are benefits we can learn from the culture he left behind." "Like what?" "Like the simplicity of life there, as opposed to our more complex one," responded Maggie. "They are do-nothing savages and will always be that way," explains Brian. "What we need to do is cleanse that young man of all that shit he has brought with him." "You can't just wipe out 10 or 11 years of a person's life and start over." "He has to have the chance to assimilate his old and new experiences," explained Maggie. "Besides, we can learn a lot from Alex and the culture he brings with him." "Like what?" asked Brian. "Life does not need to be so hard," responded Maggie. "Life is hard," adds Brian as his voice becomes louder. "What that boy needs to be taught is the Christian work ethic. That is what it takes to build a ranch like this, to say nothing about what it takes to build a country or civilization." "You are so gullible, Maggie." "Keep your voice down. You don't have to shout to get your message across to me," said Maggie. "Well, I can't help it if you seem to be brainwashed by him and where he came from," replied Brian. Next chapter. Title, The Weekend. Brian was determined to teach Alex a thing or two about what it takes to be successful. One weekend, he approached Alex and asked him if he cared to see how the ranch operated. "Operated? What does that mean?" inquired Alex. "You don't think the ranch just happens by itself, do you? It needs people working in a certain way to make it happen." "So do you want to see the people operate the ranch?" responded Brian. Alex said hesitatingly, "Okay," recognizing Brian as the alpha male of the ranch. Alex followed Brian out to the breeding stock barn. They watched a man hose down the dirt, straw, and excrement from one of the pens. "That is Tomas. We call him the greenhorn around here, since he is still starting out." Alex followed Brian to the bullpen, where there was one bull twice the size of the other heifers. "That is the guy that we extracted the sperm from to put into the females that you saw earlier," explained Brian as he pointed to the bull. "I bet you would have fun doing that?" asked Brian as he laughed. But Alex was silent, not knowing what Brian was talking about. They then got into Brian's Jeep Wrangler and drove off to one of the herds of cattle grazing on Bureau of Land Management land. The herd must have consisted of about 100 head of cattle. Two men were riding on horses with the herd, who were pointed out by Brian. Brian explained that these men were getting ready to move the cattle to another area. They sat there for a while, and sure enough, the herdsmen started to move the herd towards the east. They took off again, driving along the fence of the property, and Brian was trying to explain the size of the ranch in acres. "Would you like to herd cattle from place to place like those cowboys were doing back there?" asked Brian. Alex thought it would be fun riding one of those gentle beasts around the ranch, and he responded by nodding his head. So, they drove to the horse barn and parked behind it near the bucking corral. They both got out of the jeep and walked over to the barn entrance, where Brian called out to Bishop to get Claire ready for riding. Brian then changed his mind and yelled out to get Lightning out and ready for riding. "I suppose you want him in the bucking pen?" asked Bishop from afar. "Yes, please, Bishop, if you would. Thank you," responded Brian. Brian then told Alex to follow him out to the bucking corral, and they climbed up on its fence and sat waiting for the horse to show up. Brian gave Alex his hat since the sun was a bit hotter that day. Bishop brought out Lightning and had him line up with the fence just under Brian. Brian told Bishop that Alex was going to ride him, so Bishop moved the horse under where Alex was and told him to hop on. Alex didn't know what he meant, so he asked, "Hop on where?" Bishop sensed that there was something not right and started to say something, but Brian told him to never mind. There was a silent moment, then Alex slowly straddled the horse, and Bishop helped him get his feet secured in the stirrups and let go. The horse immediately tried to buck Alex off. Brian started to laugh as Alex tried to hold on to the saddle horn, but he just couldn't, and eventually was thrown off. "What a wimp," said Brian as Bishop ran to where Alex had landed and tried to help him up, but Alex was unresponsive. Bishop immediately stood up and told Brian that there was something wrong with Alex. "What is it now?" asked Brian. "He is not getting up," responded Bishop. "He probably fainted or something." "Go get some water and splash it on him," yelled Brian. "His ear is bleeding, sir," yelled Bishop. Next chapter. Title: The Hospital. Maggie, now sobbing, rode in the ambulance with Alex for the half hour it took to reach the emergency room at Sacred Heart Hospital at River Bend in Springfield. She was with him as the doctor and nurses worked on him. The doctor then asked Maggie what happened, and all she said was that he fell off of a horse. The doctor then instructed her to wait in the waiting room, and he would come to her with the diagnosis. An hour and a half passed before Dr. Sipes entered the waiting room and told Maggie that Alex suffered a brain injury and that his brain was swelling, so they induced a temporary coma to help. He also said that Alex has a broken left leg with a large gash, and they are giving him antibiotics to counter any infections. Dr. Sipes also told Maggie that Alex had been moved to intensive care in room 621. 2 days later, Alex developed a rash around his genitals and back. The only thing they thought it might have been was an allergic reaction, either from the coma-inducing medication or the antibiotic. It was a 50-50 chance, it was one or the other. His brain had stopped swelling, and so they decided to take him off of the coma-inducing medication. But his heart started to fail the next day, and nothing they tried helped. Alex Jr. died a day later. Next chapter. Title: The Eulogy. I gave birth to Alex Jr. on May 6, 2006, yet I have only known him for less than 2 years, for fate has its way of dealing with the living. I am not sorry for the short time I had with him or his culture, for they were a guiding light to a simpler way of life. A life that rejoiced in the fact that humans are a part of the biota and not separate from it, as many today believe it is. That we are all interconnected to one another, whether we are plant, animal, insect, or any other type of creature on Earth. Both Alex and Alex Jr. were rejected by this society on the basis that they were a threat or possessed an inferior value system, when all they were doing was pointing to the fact that the well-being of the Earth is a top priority. Like his father, Alex Penzaris, Alex Jr. made me feel ashamed to have been a conduit for the work of others who have the mistaken belief in their superiority. He and his father helped me see my way out of this supremacy quagmire and all the damage it has done to our planet. How do I start to apologize to our Earth? At what point do I begin? The subject is so vast, but your pain compels me to write and try to find an explanation. I am not to blame, but on the other hand, I am responsible. I have departed from your natural path and ended up with my head in the clouds, not able to see the reckless approaches in my advances, treading on your hallowed grounds in ignorance. I now must confess, take responsibility for my actions and the actions of those who preceded me and my clan, for they have created the great burden that I now carry. I have peeked under the fog and seen a light so bright and hard to explain. It has taken thousands of years to get to where I have reached, but I have not but a few years left in my life to help my clan at least glance at it. So, I lower my brow and look at my feet and the ground I am standing on, for there is the focus of my salvation. I then look up at the sky and observe the sun, for there is the essence of the driving force that could have led us to the way we all were meant to live. The earth and the sun were the yin and yang of the belief in the sacredness of the planet and universe. I hear your screams clearly, and I am ashamed, but yet I cannot help it. I have gotten used to my lifestyle, and even if I decide to follow the path of recovery, there is nowhere to start. For I and my clan have done away with your conventions and transformed you into an alien landscape in totality. There is nowhere to go physically to start the journey that leads to you if it is not too late. Oh, how I wish I could have just started the passage to you long ago. So, here I am writing and hoping that the others of my clan will read of you and somehow get my message, lowering their heads below the clouds to breathe some fresh oxygen and see the simple truth. It was not about wealth, power, or technology. It was about the wisdom of nature and how it balances you and the sun in the dance of life. It should all come naturally, but my clan's foreign ways are distorting their visions away from reality. I dream of the day enough people start to see the actuality of nature's way and help you in restoring dignity to your and our lives so that I am with you once again and not separate on my own with my outlandish ways. I imagine it will be in mind alone, and perhaps turn into a physical appreciation of the marvel that is you basking in the sun, that reality will sink into more and more of the lost. It was not a matter of positively thinking of nature. That was not enough. What was needed was for me to be able to stand naked in a forest and consider it home. You see, when I thought of nature, I took away from nature's gift. For I am nature and out, that I belong to nature, and not the other way around. I should not have built monuments, for nature was the builder. I should not have provided, for nature was the provider. I should only have sought my pleasures in nature and let her do all the rest. All I needed was you and the vibrantly bright sun to make happiness available to all. Why should I have aimed for the heavenly stars when heaven was here in your arms? Why should I have sought wealth when all was provided? Why should I have pursued power when it was readily available from the sun? Why should I have pursued technology, for it only kept my head up in the billows gasping for air? I now bid you all farewell, for I have decided to return to where Alex Sr. pointed the way to heaven, and where I found Alex Jr. in the Amazon River Basin. It is there that the key to a better life for all, and for the planet Earth, exists. Next chapter. Title: The Return. Not surprisingly, Maggie walked out the door of the big house without any luggage or even a carry-on. The cab was waiting for her with the engine running. The trip to the Eugene airport took half an hour, and she arrived the usual 2 hours earlier than her commuter flight out to San Francisco, where she changed planes and took off to Brasilia, the capital of Brazil. From there, she took a commuter plane to Castalia, where a helicopter took her to the original crash site. She didn't stay there long after the helicopter left, and she started to walk south toward the last place the tribe was staying. As she walked, she took off her shoes and then her blouse. Next off was her bra, then her skirt. Finally, she took off her panties, tossed them into a thicket, and disappeared into the mass of trees. Next chapter. Title: Home Again. It was mid-afternoon when Maggie started to look for her tribe in the Gaba jungle. Soon she could sense the approach of a rainstorm. Large raindrops hit the foliage and her shoulders and intensified as she moved on. At one point, the deluge was so great she could not hear anything but its crescendo. 20 minutes later, it was all over. The sound of the earth gently sucking in the water through the twigs, branches, and leaves took over with the occasional sounds of plunk and plink as water was released by the trees and hit the temporary little ponds that had formed. She soon found broken branches, decaying leaves, a few bones, and a hearth indicating she was close to the tribe, and she started to move faster. She knew she was about a mile away. Her stomach growled, and she started to jog. As she approached the campsite, she could hear the sounds of children playing and smell smoke and burning fur in the air. Many temporarily left what they were doing to greet her by touching her shoulders and saying, "Ayalomo," and she would respond with, "Ayamina." Once they started to eat, she told them what had happened to Alex Jr., Butu, in the land of the moon-faced, and the decision she made to come back. Zanuba, Alex Jr.'s tribal mother, started to wail and cry as Bongato, the tribe elder, tried to console her. As night approached, all that could be heard were the sounds of a few birds and the crackling of the fire in the middle of the camp. There were no skits or reenactments that night, but the singing of the women to the loss of Mbutu as the men laid their walking sticks down, pointing to the fire. This was symbolic of the insemination of the fire to bring new life into the tribe so that they would be stronger. The next morning, as light started to bounce through the trees, the camp was busy with activity preparing for the hunt that day. The nets were gathered by the men, the women hung satchels on their backs, and when Bongato, the eldest of the tribe, yelled, "Yala Bina," the men started in a single file to the south. The women and children waited for about an hour before starting to thrash through the jungle with branches while making noises to scare their daily protein meal into the spread-out nets. The catch was a good one, and they even had to let a few of the animals go because they had caught more than what they needed. On the other hand, the women managed to collect greens, berries, nuts, and mushrooms to make a decent meal that afternoon. As the meal was being prepared, Maggie decided to help Bongato prepare his catch, and they started to talk. "Why did you come back, Maggie?" he asked without looking at her. "I don't know exactly," she responded. "I guess because it is a much more relaxed life here than the hustle and bustle of the moon-faced world." "What is hustle and bustle?" he inquired. "Well, it has to do with the many things you need to do to get by. For example, to have a cup of morning brew, you need to work for 8 hours a day for 10 days to receive money, and then you need to use the money to pay for transportation to the place where coffee is sold. Then you take it home and make yourself a brew. But that is not all. Once every 7 days, you need to put the drink leftovers out to the street and have it picked up to go to the dump. The refuse from the dump then needs to be taken to the landfill and buried," she explained. "I didn't understand most of what you said. Here in the Gaba, the morning brew is gotten from the Galibi tree leaves like that one over there," he said as he pointed to a tree about 9 or 10 feet away. "It is cooked, drank, and its leftover leaves are left to be eaten by the Gaba. It seems to me that the moon-faced people are more complicated than they need to be," Bongato said. "You're right," she responded. Just then, Bongato motioned for Maggie to be quiet as he stood up and looked around for about 15 seconds, then sat back down and said, "I thought I heard the sound of the baobao." "What do you mean by baobao?" she asked. "A sound that does not belong to the Gaba, the sound of the bad thing." That evening, Bongato requested the skit of the killing of the baobao be performed. As the evening progressed with song and the telling of stories from the morning hunt, the children formed a snake-like creature that had a large head made of bent branches and covered with leaves, carried by the lead child. The creature invaded the calm of the campfire with loud banging of sticks on sticks. It moved closer and closer to Bongato, who pretended to be asleep. When it reached his feet, the children started to rub the sticks together and made a hissing sound. When the lead child touched Bongato's feet, Pantalimos sprang up and started to wrestle with the child and cut the creature's head off. As it fell to the ground, the rest of the creature also tumbled, and the rest of the tribe yelled, "Koawa afia Pantalimo," meaning something like, "More muscle to Pantalimo." Next chapter. Title: The Romance. Pantalimo was the accomplished hunter of the tribe. His skills included net making and placement in the hunting field. It was natural for him to be chosen to tackle the Baobao, for he was a muscular man of approximately 5'8" tall with dark brown eyes. He did not escape Maggie's eyes, for she had to take a second and third look at him whenever he came close. After the skit was over, Pantalimo sat next to Maggie and placed a twig between the toes of his left foot. Maggie didn't know what to make of this behavior, so she continued to hum along with the tribe that sang praise to the Gaba Mother. As the fire started to die out, tribespeople began to retire to their huts, and so did Maggie. She had reminiscent dreams of Alex, Alex Jr., and Ismail that night. She dreamed of Alex making love to her on the steps of the Pyramids of Giza in broad daylight after purchasing tickets at the entrance kiosk for $1 apiece, then walking the winding road to the Pyramid of Khufu. Her dream of Alex Jr. was of the time that he was given to her by Zanuba, his tribal mother, and she hugged him until he started to squirm. She also dreamed about their trip back to Oregon and what she had to do to appease his tribal diet. Then there was the dram of Ismail when he picked up the pieces after they realized Alex was dead and continued with Alex's mission. The next day she could hear an occasional giggle behind her back, and when she turned around, it got pretty quiet while people pretended to be busy. The day proceeded with the usual morning hunt, the afternoon meal, and then entertainment at dusk around the central fire. Again, Pantalimo sat next to Maggie, flexed a few muscles, and placed a twig between his toes on his left foot. And again, Maggie did not know what was going on. She started a conversation with him, and he was forward with answers. She sat there talking to him and then thought of an experiment. She placed a twig between the toes on her left foot to mimic him. He got all bent out of shape, got up, and walked off. The next day, Maggie asked Zanuba what it meant when Pantalimo placed a twig between the toes on his left foot while sitting next to her. Zanuba said that it meant he wanted to make love with you. Maggie was astonished by this revelation and was speechless for a few seconds, then asked, "How do you say no?" Zanuba said that she should place a twig between the toes of her left foot. That evening, Maggie saw that Pantalimo was sitting elsewhere. She decided to go sit next to him. She sat there quietly participating in the singing when he placed a twig between the toes on his left foot again. So she placed a twig between the toes of her right foot. A smile came over his face, and he gently took her hand, stood up, and they both disappeared into the night. Next chapter. Title: The Baobao. Soon everyone could hear the Baobao when the wind was from its direction, so they knew it was getting closer to their territory, and they started to get restless. They had fears that it would devour all their game animals and lead them to starvation. The tribe elders got together one night and devised a plan. They were going on the attack to confront the Baobao. Pantalimo volunteered for the task, and Maggie decided to go with him in case they met up with Brazilians she could communicate with. They headed in the direction of the sound it made and must have traveled about 15 or 16 miles over 11 days to the edge of their territory. The noise it made was now deafening, and when they came upon a huge clearing in the jungle, Pantalimo gasped. He had not realized that the Baobao devoured both animals and trees, leaving nothing behind but dirt. They made camp and settled down for the evening. As the campfire smoke rose through the night sky, Maggie could tell Pantalimo was nervous because he didn't participate in the song. She could conjure he was building up courage the way his eyebrows started to take a crooked path. All of a sudden, he made a huge roar and stood up holding his walking stick in the air. The next morning, they started in the direction of the Baobao noise once again, and by mid-afternoon, they came across a group of yellow Baobaos with men slaving after their every need. The men were felling trees and giving them to the Baobaos, who dragged them away. Other baobabs were devouring the brush under the fallen trees. Maggie noticed all the baobab beasts had an insignia of the Sneff Corporation painted on the cab door. Pantalimo suddenly jumped up on a fallen tree and yelled, "Kul gaba wa maut ella baobab." But none of the baobab or their slaves noticed this display, on account of the deafening noise they were so busily making. He yelled it again, and still no one paid attention. So he got down in disgust, shaking his head. Maggie pulled him back into the jungle, where they hid out for the rest of the day. As the sun receded behind the distant mountains, they decided not to build a campfire and simply ate nuts and berries that Maggie had collected on their way there. She tried to tell Pantalimo of the dangers of challenging the baobab, for they are made of iron and steel, but he didn't understand. The next day, Pantalimo decided to directly challenge a single baobab. He waited until it was loaded with a tree, and then ran up to it and started to poke it with his wooden spear. When it broke in two, he started to shoot arrows at the baobab until he ran out of arrows. But the baobab continued to do what it was doing and did not pay any attention to what Pantalimo was doing. By afternoon, all that was left was his walking stick, so he ran in front of the baobab as it was moving forward and tried to jam his stick in its tracks. But the beast jerked in his direction, and he was caught in the track mechanism, and it ripped his right arm off at the shoulder. As he lay bleeding on the ground, Maggie ran to him and tried to get him up and away from the beast. The driver of the baobab beast opened its cabin door, walked out, and climbed down to see what he had done. When he saw Pantalimo, he said, "Just some shithole natives," then climbed back up the baobab beast. Maggie noticed the name Juan Esposito on his shirt pocket. Pantalimo's right chest bones could be seen, and Maggie knew he would not survive until daybreak. She held him in her arms until he expired in the middle of the night. The next morning, she collected what she could of his, buried him in some leaves, and started her trek back to the tribe. She was soon showing a baby bump, which meant he was to bring to her his daily catch to be prepared for them both. But Bongato stepped in and did it for Pantalimo. When it was time for the baby to be born, Zanuba and Maggie disappeared from the tribe into the woods. Zanuba taught Maggie what she had to do to give birth. She taught her to find a young tree she could get her arms around and hold herself as she squatted to let gravity aid in the birthing process. After the birth of a baby girl, Maggie, the baby, and Zanuba emerged from the woods and rejoined the tribe, and life resumed for them. No name was given to the new child until it could grab Bongato's walking stick with its right hand, at which point the baby was given the name of Nasmina. Celebration of the birth did not start until she could walk, which consisted of the recognition of Nasmina as a member of the tribe. The celebration took 4 days of food, song, and dance. It was interrupted once by Bongato, who thought he had heard the sound of the baobab once again in the distance. Everyone stopped what they were doing to listen, but the wind shifted and the sound went away. Nasmina was a joy. She learned to climb and hang from trees before she could speak. She followed Maggie everywhere and learned to pick the right mushrooms during the hunt. She had large brown eyes like her father's, pudgy cheeks, and was taller than the other children. Next chapter. Title: Preparing to Battle the Enemy. Preparing to battle the enemy. As the sounds of the baobab could now be heard with a concentration of one's ears, Maggie felt that she needed to bring to justice Juan Esposito and the Sneff Corporation for what they had done to Pantalimo and the forest where they lived. She knew she had an uphill battle ahead of her. For one thing, the Obongomio tribe is not known to anyone outside the Gaba jungle, and in the same vein, Pantalimo is not a citizen of any entity despite his existence in Brazil. He has no ID card or birth certificate. Even the physical evidence of the death was now a wasteland after the bulldozers and other machines were done with their work. So how could she pursue justice when all evidence of the crime was wiped off the earth? How could she reconstruct what had happened? How do you create interest in something that is gone? How does one protect the whole livelihood of a people and their habitat? All she could think of doing was making a lot of noise where it counts, sort of rattle a few cages. Making noise in Brazil was not enough, because the SNF Corporation, she had found out, was a USA company with headquarters in Houston, Texas, so she figured she had to go to the U.S. to make a big stink about the whole issue. She arranged for Zanuba to take care of her precious daughter Nasmina while she was gone, and off she went to Castalia to call Ismail to arrange for her to return to the USA. Next chapter. The title. The trial. The judge entered the courtroom, and the bailiff said, "All rise. The Honorable Judge Gregor Paladacci of these great United States of America presiding." As the judge sat down, he said, "You may be seated." He then looked at Bailiff Anderson and said, "Please present the first case this morning, Paul." Bailiff Anderson then stood up and read from the docket on his desk. "The first case, Your Honor, is case number 342897, the petitioner Marguerite Nally from the Obongomeo tribe of Brazil versus the SNF Corporation on charges of manslaughter in the death of Pantalimo of the Obongomeo tribe. Who is representing the plaintiff?" The judge asked as he looked at Maggie sitting alone at her table. "I am representing myself, Your Honor," said Maggie. "This is highly irregular, Miss Nally, and I will not allow it. I advise you to get a competent counsel. I give you 1 week to seek and present a credible lawyer to handle your case." Bailiff Anderson looked in his calendar and said, "We can resume the case on Monday, December 10th, at 11 a.m., Your Honor." "Very well. The case will resume on Monday, December 10th, at 11 a.m., said Judge Paladacci as he dropped his gavel. As Maggie was walking out of the federal courthouse and down the outside steps, a reporter for the Houston Sentinel newspaper approached her with his business card in hand and said, "Hi, I am John Slavik of the Sentinel. What, may I ask, do you think you will accomplish by trying to sue the powerful SNF Corporation? Somebody needs to put a stop to the debauchery that is going on against those who want to be left alone to live a simple and dignified life," Maggie responded. "You will need a high-powered lawyer for your case, Miss Nally, don't you think?" he said. "All I can say is I will need a lot of help with my limited resources," she replied. "Do you know of any high-powered attorneys that would take the job for close to nothing?" she asked while giving her business card to John the reporter. "I'll see what I can do, and please send me a description of your case. Unfortunately, I am late to a meeting right now," he said as he raced down the steps and hopped in a cab. She had rented a small and modest house in a town called Sugarland on the west side of Houston. She secured the funds needed for the house and the trial by soliciting funds using GoPayMe.com. When she got home that afternoon, the first thing she did was call Ismail for help in finding a suitable lawyer who does not take an arm and leg for payment. He agreed to help and said he would call her the next day with the results. She then emailed John the reporter her opening statement she had prepared for the court session that day. Meanwhile, she started to Google for a lawyer on her own in the Houston area. She found a couple who would look at her case, but in the end, they both turned her down. One said the case was too complex, and the other said she could never win. She didn't sleep very well that evening and kept turning side to side and developed a sweat in her bed. She got up the next morning at 4:15 a.m., fixed herself a cup of coffee, and started thinking of her opening statement and how she could change it to have a greater impact. At about 3:30 p.m., she got a call from Ismail, who said he was not able to find a lawyer who would take up her case. He had found one who would consider it 6 months down the line, since he had other obligations. Maggie thanked him for his efforts and took down the names of the lawyers he contacted. She then started to think of who else could help her with her mission, and her estranged husband's name kept turning up in her mind. She knew it would be kind of awkward calling him after so many years of separation, but his status and resources were large enough, and he might be able to help her. It was after 12:30 p.m. in Oregon, so she might catch him during lunchtime at home. She picked up the phone to dial his number several times, as she thought of how she would approach the subject with him, and she then put the phone down again after realizing his attitude towards primitive natives. Finally, she got the gumption to call. Unfortunately, she got nowhere with Brian. He ended the conversation and said he can't see helping these lazy, do-nothing monkeys from shithole countries, and he hung up. In a panic, since there was a weekend coming up, she started to Google once again for a lawyer, but came up empty-handed for someone in the Houston area, so she widened her search to the Austin and San Antonio areas. She found an environmental lawyer in the latter city who was interested in taking up her case for free. His name was Elton Hughes, and he agreed to travel to Houston the next day if she would put him up for the duration of the trial. Something didn't sit right with her regarding Elton Hughes. He was just too eager. She Googled his name, and he came up with a long criminal rap sheet. She tried to call him to cancel, but the phone number he gave her would pick up his voicemail only. She left a voicemail explaining that she no longer needed his services. Feeling discouraged, she decided to try again the next day after a good night's sleep. While she was having dinner and watching the news on her TV that evening, her case against the SNEF Corporation was mentioned at the end of the broadcast. She felt like she was getting some traction with her efforts and wondered how the news got out. She figured it was John the reporter who was spreading her story. She picked up her phone and called him. "Hello, John?" she spoke. "Yes, this is John Slavik. Who is this?" "This is Maggie Nally, the one you said you would help with her court case against the SNEF Corporation." "Yes, that is right. I am glad you called. I have been broadcasting your story on the internet using every tool available, and I expect that some major news organization would pick up the story," replied John. "Well, it was on the local news channel thanks to you. I do appreciate your efforts on my behalf," she said. "No problem. My boss was intrigued by your story, and he gave me a lot of encouragement. It was front page news at the Sentinel yesterday. Did you get a chance to read it?" John said. "I am afraid not. I am sorry to have missed it, but I get most of my news from the TV. Anyway, I am glad I was of help, and I hope things work out for you," John said. About an hour later, Maggie's phone rang. It turned out to be Dalton Escalante, one of the high-profile lawyers in the country, and he wanted to take up Maggie's court case. She was flabbergasted and didn't know what to say. "Do you want me to represent you, Ms. Nally?" he asked. "Yes, I would be honored, and the Obongomio tribe would also be honored by you representing us," she replied. "I also understand that you're under a tight schedule. Is that true?" he asked. "Yes, that is true. Opening statements are due on Monday, December 10th, she replied. "I have no time to waste. I will be at your door tomorrow at 11 a.m. Is that okay?" he asked. "I will have everything prepared for your review at that time, Mr. Escalante. Please call me Dal," he said as he hung up his phone. The next day at 10:15 a.m., the doorbell rang. When Maggie looked out the side window, she found a man dressed in a suit carrying a briefcase and a suitcase, so she assumed it was Dalton Escalante. She opened the door. The man threw his suitcase through the doorway, walked in, and said, "Good morning, Maggie. I am Elton Hughes at your service." "Over my dead body," responded Maggie as she tried to throw the suitcase out again, but Elton was quick to close the door behind him. Now, Miss Maggie, that is no way to talk to your lawyer," he said. Maggie then lunged for her cell phone lying on the coffee table next to her case's dossier and dialed 911. Elton caught up with her, pressed the end button, and took the phone away from her. Less than a minute later, her phone rang and he answered it. "Hello, may I help you?" It turned out to be the 911 dispatcher asking if there was an emergency. Elton answered that it was a mistaken dialing and hung up. By that time, Elton had a tight grip on Maggie's right arm, and he proceeded to tie her hands behind her back with the electric power cord from the end table lamp next to the couch. He then started to ransack the bedroom looking for jewelry and money. The doorbell then rang again. When Elton opened the front door, he found himself facing two police officers who asked to come in. Elton tried to make a dash for his car but was stopped. As a precaution, the word went out that more police units were needed, and within 10 minutes, there were two other police cars with lights and sirens blaring coming to a screeching halt at Maggie's house. As Maggie was being untied, Dalton Escalante arrived. He was at first prevented from entering the house, but then allowed to do so when he explained who he was and why he was there. He entered the house as Maggie was standing in the bedroom, explaining what had happened and who Elton Hughes was to one of the officers. Dalton sat on the couch in the living room, noticed the identified dossier on the coffee table and started to go through it. As Maggie entered the living room, Dalton looked up and said, "I hope it is okay that I took the liberty of looking through your case, Miss Nally." He then stood up, extended his hand to shake hers, and said, "Hi, I am Dalton Escalante, better known as Dal." Next chapter. Title: The Restart of the Trial. On Monday, December 10th, the courtroom was jam-packed full of reporters and onlookers, and there was a muted hum of words that circulated in the air. At 11 a.m., the judge entered the courtroom, and the bailiff said, "All rise." The Honorable Judge Gregor Palladacci of these great United States of America presiding. As the judge sat down, he said, "You may be seated." The judge then looked at Bailiff Anderson and said, "Could you please present the next case this morning, Paul?" Bailiff Anderson then stood up and read from the docket on his desk, "The next case, Your Honor, is case number 3342897. The petitioner Maggie Nally from the Obongomeo tribe of Brazil versus the SNF Corporation on charges of manslaughter in the death of Pantalimo of the Obongomeo tribe." "Who is representing the plaintiff?" the judge asked as he looked at Maggie sitting with Dalton Escalante at her table. Dalton stood up and said, "I am, Your Honor." The judge motioned for Dalton to sit down and said, "You need no introductions, Mr. Escalante. Welcome." Judge Palladacci then paid attention to the defendant's table, where four men and one woman were sitting, and asked who was representing the SNF Corporation. "I am, Your Honor," a man said as he got up from his seat. "I am Herman Pikes of Washington, D.C." "You also need no introductions, Mr. Pikes. You may be seated," said the judge. Jury selection took 2 weeks, with both Dalton and Herman battling for the most agreeable jurors. The judge then asked Dalton to give the opening statement for the plaintiff. Dalton stood up from the desk, approached the jury stand, and said, "Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. It is a long journey from here in Houston, Texas, to the Obongomeo tribe in the southern part of the country of Brazil. But Houston is where decisions are made that affect the livelihood of people of the Brazilian jungle. It will be proven beyond a reasonable doubt that decisions made in the corporate offices of the SNF Corporation were the cause of the death of Pantalimo, who was a young man of the Obongomeo tribe. It is hoped that you can put aside any biases you may have regarding the status of tribal people versus modern man in your final verdict, and consider the victims as worthy of every ounce of respect as any modern person. Thank you." Dalton then turned to the judge and said, "That is all I have to say for now, Your Honor," and sat down. Judge Palladacci then invited the defense to give their opening statement. "Good morning to you all of the jury," said Herman as he got up from his desk. "The SNF Corporation has been doing business for over 100 years, and never has it been accused of any criminal activity. It will be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that the unfortunate events that took place in the southern Brazilian jungle were caused by the action of a person or persons not related to the SNF Corporation. That the SNF Corporation has always looked out for the well-being of the native people of the Brazilian jungle with generous offerings and help." Herman then thanked the judge for allowing him to give his opening statement and sat down. The judge looked at Dalton and said, "You may proceed with your case against SNF Corporation, Mr. Escalante." "Thank you, Your Honor," said Dalton. He picked up an envelope on his desk and retrieved from it a lock of hair held together with a blue bead. "I present to you a lock of hair from the deceased as Exhibit A." He then took out of the envelope a piece of something that looked like a leather patch and said, "This is Exhibit B, the right ear of the deceased." "Objection, Your Honor. This is highly unusual and inadmissible as evidence," Herman said as he raised his hand and stood up. The courtroom buzzed with activity and hushed voices. The judge used his gavel to calm the courtroom, looked at Dalton and said, "You have some explaining to do, Mr. Escalante." "Your Honor, there are no such things as phones, cameras, police, detectives, fingerprints, autopsies, or death certificates in the Amazon jungle. That should not distract from the fact that a death has occurred. What I can provide as proof is a lock of hair in the right ear of the deceased, along with an eyewitness to the crime." The judge then put the palms of his hands together and up to his forehead in deep thought. After about 15 seconds, he looked up and said, "Objection overruled. Mr. Escalante, please call your witness." "I call Margaret Nally to the witness stand, Your Honor," Dalton said. Maggie stood up, moved into the witness stand, and the bailiff swore her in. Dalton then approached the witness stand and asked, "Please state your name to the court." And she did so. Then he asked about her relationship with the deceased, and Maggie responded that he was a member of the Obongomio tribe, of which she, Maggie, was also a member. "Did you witness the death of Pantalimo?" he asked. "Yes, I did," she responded. "And where did he die?" he asked. "In the Gaba jungle area." "How did he die?" he asked. "He was run over by a bulldozer," Maggie responded. "Do you know who killed Pantalimo?" "Yes, I do," Maggie responded. "Who killed Pantalimo?" "A man by the name of Juan Esposito." "Is Mr. Juan Esposito a member of your tribe?" "No, he is not," Maggie responded. "How did you come to know Mr. Juan Esposito?" Dalton asked. "He came out of the bulldozer cab after running over Pantalimo." "Do you know who Juan Esposito works for?" asked Dalton. "Yes," replied Maggie. "Who does Juan Esposito work for?" "S&F Corporation," Maggie responded. The courtroom immediately buzzed with voices of shock and the scuffle of feet. "Objection! This is hearsay, Your Honor," said Herman as he raised his hand and stood up. "Order in the court," said the judge in a commanding voice as he banged his gavel on his desk. After 20 seconds, the courtroom became silent. "It will be clear to the court in a minute how Ms. Nally knew Juan worked for the SNF Corporation, Your Honor," said Dalton. "Objection overruled," said the judge. "You may proceed, Mr. Escalante." "Ms. Nally, how do you know that Mr. Juan Esposito worked for the SNF Corporation?" "He wore a shirt that had the SNF Corporation logo embroidered on the left-hand pocket," she responded. "Objection! Mr. Esposito could have picked up the shirt anywhere, Your Honor," said Herman. "Sustained," said the judge as he looked at the clock hanging over the entrance to the courtroom. "Time is up, gentlemen and ladies of the court," he said as he leaned towards the bailiff and whispered. The bailiff then stood up and said, "The next court session will be Wednesday, December 12th, at 1 p.m. Although it was only noon, Maggie was exhausted by then, and she went straight home, but not before she and Dalton had discussed and agreed to meet Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. to go over strategy and how they will proceed with questioning in court that day over a cup of coffee in the courthouse cafeteria. The next day at noon, Maggie had been watching the local news when a breaking story interrupted the broadcast. It was about a lynching in Baytown, which is part of Harris County and on the southeast side of Houston. The castrated victim had a sign pinned to his jacket that read, "No nigger is going to mess with my daughter." And on a short brick fence about 30 feet away were what appeared to be the victim's laid-out penis and testes. There were no identifying documents on the body, so its identity had to be done differently. There hadn't been a lynching in over 40 years, so this was big news, and the talk of the town in Sugarland. It brought out racial tensions hidden in all those past years and fear in the African-American communities where police presence was beefed up. There were peaceful demonstrations in front of the courthouse later that day, covered by all the local media and preempting the regular scheduled programs. The next day, Maggie proceeded to meet Dalton in the courthouse cafeteria, but he was a no-show. She tried to call him on his cell phone, but there was no answer. She called his hotel, and they told her that he had not checked in since Monday. When 1 p.m. approached, she entered the courtroom and sat at the plaintiff's desk. Unfortunately, the trial could not proceed without Dalton, so it was rescheduled for Friday, December 14th at 10 a.m. Maggie decided to cool off at the corner pub where she ordered a blue sapphire martini with three olives. As she sipped, she saw Dalton's picture on the TV over the bar, but the pub was too noisy for her to hear what was said. She got up from her table and proceeded to sit at the bar to better hear the TV. An olive slipped out from between Maggie's lips and down her shirt as she froze when the announcer said the lynched man's identity was that of Dalton Escalante, the famous lawyer from Atlanta, Georgia. His wallet was found in a dumpster in the vicinity of the body. Maggie's head was spinning with a thousand thoughts about her long journey from the Amazon to Houston, Dalton, Pantalimo, Juan Esposito, the trial, and what she had promised the tribe. Her whole plan of seeking justice was falling apart. After gaining some thought stability, she managed to make it back home and called Ismail. She explained to him what had happened and asked for advice on what to do next. Ismail sensed that she needed him close by, so he took a few days off from work and was down in Sugarland the next day, Thursday, the 13th of December. As they sat in her living room discussing what to do next, it suddenly occurred to Ismail that the death of Dalton was not a hate crime, but an attempt to shut down the trial. "Can you see that it is too much of a coincidence for this to happen?" Ismail said. It was then realized the importance of finding a good lawyer for Maggie as soon as possible. "What was the name and number of the reporter who initially helped you gain exposure for your need for a lawyer?" asked Ismail. Maggie dialed John Slavik's number. When he answered, she introduced herself, and he immediately knew why she was calling. "I will see what I can do, Miss Nally," he said. She then added their suspicions about the killing of Dalton. This sounded the alarms in John's mind, and he took even greater interest in the case. "Can I come over and discuss these matters with you and your friend?" he asked. Approximately an hour later, John arrived at Maggie's residence, and all three huddled. Ismail explained to John the reasoning behind suspecting Dalton was killed to deny Maggie a lawyer and to serve as a warning to others from taking up the case. John, on the other hand, said the police had not indicated that this was anything but a hate crime and were proceeding on that basis in their investigation, according to his sources. Maggie suggested an article be written in the Sentinel newspaper, spelling out the coincidence of the crime to the trial and accusations against the SNF Corporation to wake up the police to this possibility. Ismail interjected and said, "We are now dealing with two killings." And he indicated they should concentrate their scarce resources on one case only. "But which one?" inquired John. "I think we should concentrate on solving the killing of Dalton," Maggie said. "Why is that?" asked John. "It is simply because the crime occurred here and not thousands of miles away. The evidence I have against SNF Corporation in the case of Pantalimo's killing will be harder to prove because Juan is there in the Gaba jungle and not here, while the killer of Dalton is here in the U.S., if not in the Houston area," Maggie explained. "But we don't know the killer of Dalton," exclaimed Ismail. "We will let the police do that bit of work for us," said Maggie. On Friday, Maggie called the courthouse to see if the trial was still on at 10 a.m. and found out it had been postponed until further notice. An hour later, John showed up at her doorstep with a cameraman, and they proceeded to take down the accusation that Dalton's killing was to shutter Maggie's attempts to prosecute the SNF Corporation for the killing of Pantalimo. The next day, the Sentinel newspaper had the headline, "Dalton Hate Crime Delusion." Ismail left Sugarland the next day to get back to work on Monday, leaving Maggie alone to deal with the fallout from the newspaper article. But there was an unsettling silence about the article. The police did not respond the way a person would think they would be questioning Maggie or the SNF Corporation. Monday morning, Maggie was walking to the neighborhood grocery store to purchase a quart of milk and donuts for breakfast when a van stopped next to her on the street. The side door opened, and two men pulled her inside. As it sped off, a gunny sack was placed over her head. She started to kick and scream, but to no avail as they hogtied her with duct tape. About 10 minutes later, she could hear sirens blaring. The van stopped suddenly and tipped over on its side. Maggie hit her head and lost consciousness. She awoke in a hospital bed with a policeman sitting at her side. She asked him what had happened, and he responded, "You were in an accident, ma'am." Soon, a police detective showed up to ask her questions and divulged she was kidnapped by the SNF Corporation, that the police had been working on the theory that Dalton's death was not a hate crime from the beginning. And when the Sentinel published her story, they immediately assigned a couple of officers to her residence. They were the ones who called in for help in stopping the getaway van. The SNF Corporation was put on trial a few months later, and its CEO was charged with the murder of Dalton Escalante. The trial news made it to the national level. It was on the front page of most newspapers and every news channel on TV. Commentaries included the plight of the jungles of South America and its inhabitants. After the trial was over, Maggie was on her way back to the Gaba jungle and her tribe. Next chapter. Title: Apocalypse Eden. From Castalia, she hired a helicopter to take her to the site of the downed plane. The landscape was a lot different than it was 30 years earlier when the plane went down. It now had barren vistas between corridors of green lining the tributaries to the Amazon River. The helicopter landed in the middle of a large barren spot. She asked why they were stopping there, and the pilot told her that this was the GPS coordinates to where the plane had crashed. "This can't be," she yelled. "This just isn't true," she cried. "Where is my baby?" she said as the tears raced down her cheeks. She asked the pilot as she sobbed, "Where did the people who lived there go?" referring to her tribe. The pilot said he did not know. When she pressed him for answers, he responded and said they might have starved to death or been taken to work at the bauxite mines as laborers. Maggie fell to her knees, holding her face in her hands as her tears made muddy puddles in the barren dirt. Who among us will lead to the oasis of wisdom, quench our thirst, and save our precious and beautiful earth?